morning, everyone, and for those of you in the room, welcome to GE Global Research. I'm Mark Little. I'm the leader of GE Global Research and the Chief Technology Officer for GE. For those of you on the webcast, welcome. Thanks for giving us the time today. We're here today to talk to you about how we win with technology. At GE, we solve some of the toughest problems in the world. We can innovate at scale. We deliver great products to our customers to help them win in their marketplaces. We know that winning products need to be at the right cost, so we use our technology to focus on that as well. We drive all these technologies into our installed base to provide opportunities for our customers to improve their products in service, and we have new muscle in analytics. All of these things together are helping us win great market share today. We're going to tell you stories given by our great business leaders across their enterprises, and we'll show you how our portfolio is winning very substantially in the marketplace today. I've been a GE officer for 21 years. I've been here at GE Global Research for about 10 years, and I can tell you with great confidence our product portfolio and our service portfolio has really never been stronger, and I think you'll see rich evidence of that today. These same technologies help us improve our margins. We are very much focused on driving technologies that give us cost advantage. You will see examples of that in manufacturing technologies. You'll see how we're using new design tools to drive speed and efficiency in every bit of our operation. We're using new testing techniques, such as in Greenville, to get our products to market fast and efficiently. We're even doing something that in my day, in my early career, was against every grain that we had across the company, and that is to vertically integrate. We made a great living for many years sourcing products all around the world, and while we still do that with pride, we're finding that we're inventing technologies that give us competitive advantage, and we're working with partners to do those things ourselves. A different day for GE. You're going to hear today about our idea of a Brilliant Factory, where we're driving significant productivity across the 400 factories in the GE system. While services are not the focus of our activities today, I want to assure you that these same technologies that play so well for us in the new product side give our customers real advantage in the services side and the installed base as well. We want to talk to you about the GE Store. You know it has several legs. There's a leadership leg, there's a global growth and operations leg, and there's a services leg. We're here to talk to you about the technology piece of this today. Who shops at the GE Store? All of our business partners do. We share together in a rich suite of technologies. We share best practices and ideas, and we transfer technology from one business to another very rapidly. At the center of all this is GE Global Research, which has been the cornerstone of our technology play for many, many, many years. Who are we? We're the first industrial research laboratory formed in the United States. In 1900, out of the early sites of General Electric, one nearby in Schenectady, our forefathers believed then, as we believe now, that technology and innovation are at the heart of making a great industrial company. They brought a young professor out of MIT. He came part-time for a while because he wasn't sure that this industrial research was an interesting thing. He fell in love with it. He left MIT and came here full-time, and he ran the place for 32 years. Ever since then, we've been going strong. You well know that many great industrial research centers in the United States have come. Many have gone. We're still here, and we're standing stronger than ever. We're at the core of the technology initiatives across the company, and we are the focal point for the 50,000 technologists across this great company. For the first 100 years of our company, we were only here in upstate New York. But as we turned into the new century, we started to spread out across the world. First to Bangalore, India, then to Shanghai, China, then to Munich, Germany, and we came back to the United States, to the Detroit area, to do advanced manufacturing and software. As we turned into the next decade, we continued to build out. We went to Rio de Janeiro, and we built a software center in Silicon Valley to attract the great talent there. And we continue to build out in Israel and now in Oklahoma for a center focused on the oil and gas industry. We build out to get great access to important talent all around the world and to be close to our customers who are innovating in markets that are important to us. This is a very tightly knit global network of deep technologists who support all the company's businesses. What is our role in the GE Store? You can well imagine that we do the foundational technologies. We have great depth in material science. We work in the things like fundamentals like high-performance computing and Advanced Aerodynamics that all of the GE businesses can share in. We have a role to spread ideas very rapidly. So if we develop a new alloy or new composites technology for power and water, we'll spread it to aviation, then to oil and gas. If we develop a new inspection technology for human bodies and healthcare, we'll then use it in our oil and gas business to inspect pipelines, and on and on and on we go. We use our technology strengths to think about acquisitions, not only in the technologies that they can bring into GE, but what we can bring to them. And we're very active partners in thinking about what businesses we should acquire and then helping those acquisitions be successful. And we nurture innovations that are outside the core of our businesses. We'll show you some examples of those things today, like solid oxide fuel cells. We've done great things to build a new cell therapy business inside of healthcare, and on we go. And as you know, we've made a very substantial push to build out our digital capability at real scale. The center of that is our new software center in San Ramon, California, where a few years ago we had Bill Rue and his admin, and now we have 1,000 people, and we're building a network across the company to use those great digital skills at big, big scale. And I have a role to work with the engineering community. We have an engineering leaders council across the CTOs and all the businesses, and we shape the technology agenda for the company. We share best practices. We build tools and techniques together, and we even share people. You will often find people coming from the research center going to the businesses, people going from business to business, and it creates a rich environment for technology sharing and growth for our people. I just want to give you a few examples of the kinds of things that we do. I had mentioned solid oxide fuel cells. This is a technology we've been working on in the lab for a number of years, and we got to the point where we got an incredible breakthrough in making a very cost-effective fuel cell. We like it so much, we're building out a business. You can see us cutting the ribbon for this business here last year. You will, those of you who are here will meet Johanna Wellington later on, and she'll tell you with great excitement about the business that she's building out. The idea here is that we build a very low-cost fuel cell, which extracts electricity from the fuel, could be natural gas or a reformed distillate, take the electricity out of that, and then burn the residual fuel in a reciprocating engine or maybe even a gas turbine someday. The combination of those two things can be 65 to 70% efficient. That's even more efficient than the best central stations today. So this is an inversion of the paradigm where central stations have been more efficient than locally generated power forever. So we're very excited about building this out, and we're scaling up as rapidly as we can go. Here's a different kind of thing. We talk about here at GE Global Research working on extreme machines. These are machines that require very high performance in very rugged environments. A good example of this is subsea, and you can see we use the entire GE store to make a strong play for us in subsea. Advanced materials coming from aviation, inspection technologies coming from healthcare, and on and on and on it goes. Now, just to pause on the oil and gas space, it's obvious to the casual observer with the drop in oil prices created some stress in the industry, but I still believe very strongly this is a great space for GE to be in. We can bring technologies from all of our businesses to play in an industry that is starved for technology. I believe strongly that the world will be using oil and gas fuels for a long time to come. Fuels will be coming from more difficult places to extract those fuels. We will bring the technologies to our customers to enable them to do that. And while the industry is in a rocky patch right now, we are committed, we're going to sustain our technology investment, and we're playing to win. We have a very good track record of working through cycles. Tina Donatkowski is going to talk to you today about how our customers were telling us, don't bother to invest in low emissions technology for the rail industry, we don't need it now. We stayed the course, we invested, and we've got the only product in a market that needs that product today. You remember at the 9/11 time, the airline industry was under extreme pressure when that tragic event happened and the industry backed up in a strong way. We stayed the course, we've invested, and we're winning today. Bill Fitzgerald will tell you about that. And I have a very personal experience. Some of you will remember this. Back in the early 1990s, papers like the Wall Street Journal were writing about the terrific product problems we have. I was the leader of engineering in the power business at the time. I went to the GE store. I got people from the research center then, people from the aircraft engine business to help us. We fixed our product problems. Then when the market started to turn up in the late 1990s, we were there with the best machines in the industry, even though we'd just come through a dark time. The market lit off. We got great share. We got price up. We got cost down. Those of you who were around then will remember something we call the U.S. power bubble. We turned a business that was losing money into the most profitable business in the company. Even today, the F machines that we installed, over 1,000 of back then, are a source of great revenue and profitability for our power business. The point is, we know how to live through cycles. This is a great space for us to be in, and we're committed to living through this cycle as well. Very different kind of thing is in life sciences. We bought a great business not too long ago that had very significant capability in biology. We have great engineering capability here at the research center, and together with our partners in the business, we're building out factories now that can produce biopharmaceuticals. We know how to grow cells, purify them, extract them, and this enables therapies like modern-day therapies and T cells, where we can extract your own cells, amplify them, purify them, and reinject them back into you to blunt deadly diseases like cancer. Really great business for us and very high technology. Then there's the industrial internet. I mentioned building out our capability in San Ramon, California. This is a very exciting space for us. We had an idea to do something in software. We've built up our strength. We're building a platform that we call Predix that enables us to build applications across our own company with speed and efficiency. We're already showing tremendous benefit in our contractual services area and then broadly in our services space. We're building out what we call Predictivity solutions on top of that to enable our customers to use their assets more productively. We're even in the process of taking this new platform out and enabling customers beyond GE's conventional space to use this platform. This is an incredibly powerful new space for us. Because we come from an industrial viewpoint, we think we can help our customers in a way that no other company can. Then there's FastWorks. We went to Silicon Valley to learn some best practices. I was personally quite amazed at what we could learn, and we have adopted something we call FastWorks. Here's the idea coming out of Silicon Valley, a consultant we had named Eric Ries who helped us think about this. The idea is to get to market fast, to try your ideas out, let customers give you feedback as quickly as you can. This has really changed the way we think about developing new products and has really been an exciting new initiative that plays very well inside the GE Global Research Network and very powerfully across all of our businesses. Just to summarize, we've been investing quite substantially in technology. You can see we're now 5% or so of industrial revenue. It wasn't all that long ago. We were about 2% or 3% of industrial revenue spending on research and development. In the dark days of the financial crisis, Jeff decided to accelerate our spending. We boosted it up, and now we're sustaining at that level. I think you will see today that our investments are paying off across a set of great new product launches that really are positioning us very, very well in the marketplace. We've really boosted our spending, and the results are showing. We've got, I think, a very nice agenda for you today that will give you some insight into what we're doing with technology in the company and how we're winning. We really are delivering winning products for our customers. We are really focused on making those sustainable by driving cost-effectiveness into those products and continuing to get them to be more and more competitive over time. All of this feeds into our service activities in a very substantial way, and you will see example after example of how our businesses are leveraging the power of GE in what we call the GE Store. Let's get started. Kristine Furstas is going to kick us off by talking about the activities we have in what we call the Brilliant Factory.
Thank you, Mark. Good morning, everyone. I'm Kristine Furstas. I've been with General Electric for about 26 years, and my current role is Director of Manufacturing and Materials Technologies, where I lead a great group of researchers across the globe, investing in those technologies, developing them for the betterment of our products and services, and working with the leadership across the company on how to implement those technologies, match their needs, both near-term and long-term. I'm going to talk to you about what GE has launched called the Brilliant Factory. What is the Brilliant Factory? Well, it's really that nexus of advanced manufacturing, physical assets, processes, tools, things that we do every day to make our products great, to fulfill our needs for our customers, with the power of the industrial internet, the ability to collect data like never before, the ability to analyze data like never before, the ability to get insight and to make a difference and an impact. What is this doing? It's making us work together in ways like never before. Well, we've always worked together. It allows us to get better insight. It allows us to collaborate both within GE, with our customers, with our supply chain, to be able to understand how can we continuously optimize, how can we learn, adapt, and grow. This is making an impact not only on how we work, but on what it means to the company. Because it's leading to productivity. It's leading to our ability to make a real difference in our day-to-day operations within our company and with our customers. And in fact, we calculate that for 1% productivity savings across the enterprise in which we're working, that's $500 million for GE, making a real difference. Now, a core part of the Brilliant Factory is what we call the digital thread. Now, it sounds like a great term, but what it really means is that in order to effectively collaborate, we have to be looking at the same data. We have to be able to cut it in many different ways. An engineer may want to look at the data one way, a customer a different way, a supplier, and our factories a third way. And to be able to share data in ways that we can all understand and make sure that we flow it both from engineering design to the factory to our suppliers to our service shops, but also so critically back, understand how producible was a given design. How did parts flow? How did suppliers perform? Were we able to meet all the fulfillment needs of our customer? To be able to gather that data, we need to be looking at it in the same ways, but within the tools we need to do the analytics at each individual step. So GE is investing in this digital thread, and it's so important to us to be able to make sure that we can have this collaboration and truly meet this productivity. Let me show you an example of how we're looking at it and what the type of impact can be. We worked with our facility in Power and Water, located in Greenville, South Carolina, where they produce many different products, including gas turbines and parts of our wind product. We went through the factory, and we looked at what this nexus of advanced manufacturing and industrial internet, the Brilliant Factory, can do, connecting the teams, being able to continuously optimize. And you can see the types of impacts as we start with our engineering teams doing the design, flowing their ideas onto the factory floor able to give feedback real time where we're really designing the products, and then out to our suppliers so they understand the impact. And in fact, we estimate that over the next 3 years, we could save $100 million as we implement these types of changes, these types of new collaborations and tools. This pilot for us is serving as a template to now go to every one of our businesses, all of their factories, and understand where can we make the difference. Because our factories are very different, just like our products are different. Some of them make parts themselves. Some of them assemble. Some of them do services or remanufacturing. And each may need a different set of tools. But by taking the time, being thoughtful, understanding our enterprise, yet understanding we want to move fast to get that productivity, we have great ways now of doing the analytics, doing the return on investment to understand the impact. Now, I started the discussion by saying we're going to have that new nexus. And it's really this idea of physical advanced manufacturing meets digital, the industrial internet. Let me give you some real examples. These are just a few examples of the types of things that we're doing. We're investing in 3D printing. Some of you may have heard of this, but for those who haven't, it's a new way of doing manufacturing. Most manufacturing is what we call subtractive. You take a part, you machine off, or you drill off, or you grind off different parts of the material to get it to the final shape. I'm sure if those of you have been in factories, many of you have seen those types of operations, and it's the core of what we do. But there's a new technology out there called 3D printing. And in 3D printing, what you're actually doing is building up layer by layer, not subtracting from a starting piece, but building up layer by layer the shape, putting material exactly where you want it and building it up. What does this do? It opens up a whole new paradigm for our engineering teams. they can now make different types of components, different types of parts that they couldn't make before, because in order to traditionally manufacture, you need to be able to see a surface. You need to be able to see the surface you're going to machine or grind or drill. In 3D printing, you don't need that. And so it's opened up a new paradigm, and what we found is that applying it to specific parts, new types of designs, we can get performance improvement of up to 80%. Now, why is this physical meets digital? Because a key part of this is that you take the idea, you can turn it into a computer file very quickly, very easily, and then it downloads right into the machine that does the 3D printing. It opens up a new paradigm, and we're starting to use it to do more iterations with the designs because we could try things faster, and it gives us better fidelity, better reliability, faster cycle time in our MPIs. We can not only use it to make parts, we can use it to make tooling or the molds that make the parts, and we've taken what typically means 6 months down to 3 weeks. That is physical meets digital. We drill holes in parts for many of our turbo machinery products. Now, why do we drill holes in parts? Because we want to push the most power out of our machines for our customers. And that means that sometimes we actually run our metals up to their melting point. We don't want to do that because we need the reliability. We need to be very able to service these parts at the end. And so we put very fine holes. Now, these aren't big, large holes. They're holes the diameter of just a few hairs, and they're very specifically placed. They have very small sizes, very sharp shapes, and we need to be able to do that in a way to enable products like our LEAP or our HA turbine to meet the kind of efficiencies and performances that we are guaranteeing to our customers. Now, we've done these processes. We use lasers to drill holes. We use very special electronic type of products to do that. But it's very difficult, and so it's a slow process. And sometimes we couldn't put the hole in the right place or get the right shape. So we'd have to go back and rework it. It was very, very tedious. What did we do? We put sensors right on the end of our drill bit, right on the end of the laser or the electronic device. And we're constantly getting feedback as we're drilling the hole. Where are you? What shape are you? That's digital meets physical. And what was the impact? We were able to improve our yield, or how many parts go through perfect the first time, by 50%. That's productivity, that's speed, that's impact. We were actually able to speed up the process because now we had confidence. We started this in our aviation business, and now we're spreading it across all of GE. Finally, let me talk about when parts come back from the field. We have a great services or remanufacturing operation where we take parts and we make them better for our customers to be able to put back in their product. Well, when parts come back from being in service, and sometimes up to 40 years for something like a steam turbine, they don't look exactly like they did when we first shipped them. Now, to be able to understand what's its shape now, where do I need to put more material, where do I need to take away material, where do I need to do things like welding, it was very, very, again, tedious to understand, to measure. But we use now digital tools to go in, and in a matter of less than an hour, we can scan the whole part using technology from our healthcare business, now adopted into industrial, be able to understand where do we need to repair, just repair there, how does it work. We are getting productivity of up to 4 times from these new technologies. We're able to have the efficiency of our workers go from about 12% of when they're doing real work and not preparing to over 70%. Not only is this making an impact on today's repairs, but it's now enabling new repairs. That's the power of physical meets digital. In addition to these types of operations, we go onto our factory floors. We go out to our supply chain. We're now able to collect more data. How are parts flowing through the factory? How are they being received by our customers? How are they able to meet the supply chain needs in various locations around the globe? We apply our advanced analytics that we now have the capability of from our software team, and we're getting tremendous impact and productivity because we're reducing variation. We can understand when a machine needs service. We can understand if a machine goes down, how to reroute. We can understand, as suppliers are sending in parts, if there is variability, how we have to react. It's real-time optimization to make that impact. Let's look at a part and how we bring this all together. This is something called a composite fan blade. You'll hear more about it from Bill Fitzgerald in a few moments. It's a key enabler for our aviation business to get the types of performance. What are composites? They're very complex material systems that are made up of both a reinforcing material as well as a base material. It's very complex. It's very difficult to design with, but it's something that we know gives us lighter weight, stronger material, more power, more efficiency. So GE manufactures it. We insource it because it's so critical and requires such deep knowledge of the material system, the design, the manufacturing. And now we apply concepts of our Brilliant Factory. We use something called informatics. We're collecting data at every individual machine. Is this part being made the way we need it to? Was this batch of material we got from the supplier exactly the same as the one before? And when it's not, we understand how to adapt. We're applying learnings from our factory to our engineering team to get better designs the next time. We're automating more of the processes. We're able to open up new ecosystems with software and materials because we have that confidence. What was the impact? Well, typically when we introduced a new part, the first time yield, the first time we sent the first batch of parts through, how many came out the way we wanted, was 20%. Now, that's typical for a very complex system, very complex design. By putting these tools in, we now are launching new parts with 95% yield. That's the impact of the Brilliant Factory. Why am I so bullish about this? Well, because we have the capabilities within GE to do this. This requires advanced controls, advanced sensors, the operational knowledge of how the factory has to work, how the materials are. We're now using our new software called Predix to be able to combine these various tools and be able to customize them factory by factory. This allows us to grow quickly because we can pull on the learnings from across GE. We can pull on all the technologies and make sure that we are making the impact as quickly as we can, but with just the right tools and right the right place. And in fact, I'm very bullish. As we continue to grow these tools, we've just started our journey, we can save up to 20% on manufacturing time and cost. That's real impact. Now, what's our motto for the Brilliant Factory? Well, we are getting data from so many places, from individual machines, from controllers, from different types of systems. They've grown over time. They've been able to go onto the factory floor. What kind of manufacturing execution system do you have? What type of quality system? And instead of trying to make everyone standard, we use Predix to be able to take that data, be able to sort it and tag it in ways, and then put these apps on top. An app can be, how do you put a sensor to make sure you get good feedback? How do you put a model to understand how you can go through the factory floor? It's a GE app store that allows us to customize for each factory, to right size what we need for those operations for that type of impact. And we also want to be able to use great tools that suppliers use. Some of them are great models, great controllers, great sensors or systems. And what we've done is we've developed, along with MIT, something called a digital manufacturing commons that allows us to protect our intellectual property, our suppliers, but get them right into the App Store using Predix as an enabler. It's an intriguing new business model that allows us to make an impact and make a difference for GE. As I said, 1% productivity, 500 million. This is what the Brilliant Factory is about. Thank you for your time, and I'd now like to introduce Vic Abate.
Great. Christine, thank you. And good morning, everybody. And just by way of introduction, as Christine said, my name is Vic Abate. I head the Power Gen Products business, which is our gas turbine business in power. And just been in that role since 2013. Prior to that, I ran the wind business for 8 years, so that was a lot of fun there. Then just prior to that, I was the engineering vice president for power gen technology. The reason I walk you through that is in the spirit of the GE Store and using technology to differentiate in the marketplace and provide value for our customers. I think a big part of that is understanding the technology and getting more engineers into business leader roles and product management roles has really been a key strategy for us over the last decade. From a power gen products perspective, the way we think about our business is myself, we have the new power plant business, and then we have the service business run by Paul McElhaney. When you put those two together, it's nearly $15 billion in 2014, and we see continued momentum, which I'll walk you through. A lot of exciting things currently going on in our business on products. I'll highlight today the H-System, but that by no means is the only thing we're doing. We're doing a lot not only in the large heavy-duty gas turbine space, but on the smaller side as well, helping out more in the distributed generation, as well as with steam turbines and generators. The key technology imperatives, what do we focus the research center and our engineers on? It's all about the customer. The beauty of our business is you don't sell power plants on style, you sell them on economics. I'll show you that we can clearly change the economics with technology, and that provides a differentiated position for the power plants that GE sells versus our competitors. The other aspect is from a new unit perspective. If we grow our installed base, that drives the service revenue and the entitlement for that business long term. The flip side is we have the largest installed base, so as we move those new products forward, putting that technology into our installed base helps our services business and expands margins not only on the new unit side, but across the entire portfolio. Just to start off with the market, the way we think about the market is twofold. You need to look at energy, and then you need to look at capacity. This is really the intersection of our new units and services. In both cases, we see a nice tailwind over the next decade for our gas position as a piece of the mix. Just for starters on energy, 23,000 terawatt-hours of energy was generated in 2013. Over the next 10 years, we see that growing to 31,000. That's net of efficiency and demand-side management. One of the things with our renewables business and storage and those aspects, we've got the full space covered. From a power generation perspective, that 31 would be 35. There's four terawatt-hours that are taken away with that. Still net of that, it's a 3% CAGR as a backdrop for the energy. That's really the service model. That's how well the assets are utilized, and that drives our service business forward with that kind of tailwind as a CAGR. In the center is the new capacity. What new capacity needs to be added to support that growth of electricity demand? That's 2,800 gigawatts over the next 10 years. I've used this chart in other forums, and that includes 600 gigawatts of, or 500 gigawatts of retirements, but also for our distributed power business, there's 600 gigawatts of non-grid connected capacity in addition to that. This is just grid connected at 2,800. When you look at the mix, for the first time, and I've been 25 years in power, for the first time looking at these charts, you see gas now is the number one new capacity addition, passing coal, something that historically coal has always been number one. Between gas and coal, it's 58% of the total. You can see wind, solar, nuclear, and hydro. Also on the electricity generation, gas goes from 5.1 terawatt-hours to, or 1,000 terawatt-hours to 7.6. Again, tremendous amount of momentum on the gas space and something we're, you know, very well positioned on and continue to invest in going forward. Relative to the gas turbine fleet, our fleet is 4,500 units, the largest in the industry with over 190 million operating hours of experience. Extremely important to our customers, extremely important to the industry and to our engineers to take that data and to continue to move the technology forward. On the key metrics our customers care about, reliability, availability, things that allow them to be more economical than their peers, the GE fleet runs better than the fleet in total by a half a point, as well as in some cases, a point and a half. Something we're very proud of and continue to march forward. On the right, the strongest catalog, and I wanna take a moment on this. Each of you, when you came today, got a copy of our 2015 product catalog for power gen. Why is this important? When you think about taking technology, high-tech capabilities like material science, and then you take a customer need what's the intersection of that? For us, that really shows up in our product catalog. For our product management team, which is a very strategic organization, how do you measure their results? How do you reward and incentivize them to come out with better stuff? Our 2015 catalog, if you take the specs in that catalog, we've moved output, we've improved efficiency across the portfolio of our products. And compared to the 2014 catalog, for the transactions that we bid, it's over $600 million of value that was created from 14 to 15 from our product management pulling all the technologies forward into the marketplace. And this is something in 2016, 2017, 2018, we continue to do and have a roadmap for, so this is a way to hold the whole entire business team accountable for delivering results on behalf of the customer. So how does technology connect into our power business? And really, this is a very simple chart that illustrates why we're so excited about this particular space. If you look at the left-hand side, it shows combined cycle efficiency, which units that have a higher efficiency are going to have a lower cost of electricity, and as a result, they're going to get dispatched more, and they're going to run more. And therefore, if you own that asset, you're going to make more money. So that's a key attribute for our customers. And if you look in 1972, we introduced the E-class of gas turbine. First one still running today, 40 years later. There's 3,000 of those machines running. And they fired in the 2,000 degree range to 2,300. As Mark talked about, the F gas turbine, which was launched in 1986, that fired about 300 degrees hotter. And we have over 1,000 of those running today, actually about 1,500. And then in 2003, we introduced the steam-cooled H turbine that fired north of 2,600. So you can see, as you push firing temperature, you're pushing efficiency. So that's the objective, to help drive value. The challenge with that is when you're firing at 2,600, 2,700, 2,800, you're 300 to 400 degrees hotter than the melting point of the base metal. And that's the technology challenge that we have for our teams here. And so that gets into materials, cooling, combustion, some of the aspects you'll see on your tours. But for us, this has enabled us to march forward at a faster pace on this key value creation item, which is efficiency in the gas turbine space. So when you look at the H spot, you can see to the right, this is the segment growth by type of class of product. You can see the H-class product is growing the fastest, that space, with about a 38% CAGR from 2011 to last year. With about a third of the market being the H, we see that over time becoming about half. And then the F now is 50% of the market, with the B's and E's continuing to get compressed. The installed base is something we continue to upgrade. So the beauty of that H technology, it flows down into the F's. So those 1,500 machines, Paul and his team take that H technology and they provide what they call advanced gas paths. We take the F class, put it into the installed base for the E's, and that's how you continue to move the customer base forward. So when we think about our H product, it isn't about a unit and it's not about a power plant. We see this as a transformation for the gas power sector over the next 15 to 20 years. And why is that? It's on size and efficiency. And so that's driven the economics of a combined cycle power plant significantly forward with this latest technology. And a simple way to think about it is one H gas turbine produces the same output in megawatts as two Fs. And on an efficiency basis, it's moved about 5 points, the capability on efficiency. So between now and 2030, our view is we're going to plant 500 Hs in the ground, right? And when you look back, if it produces twice the power of the Fs, we have 1,500 Fs. They produce twice the power of the Es, we have 3,000 Es. So that's the march we're on, and it's a $2 billion investment. And this is something, you know, our customers, I'll show you, are reacting to very positively. What does that fleet of 500 Hs do for the market? It saves our customers $30 billion in CapEx. So to build out the next generation of gas, I can do it $30 billion cheaper with this technology. That fleet that I own consumes $8 billion a year less in fuel to generate the same electricity. And the flip side, because it's dispatched further down the curve, it runs twice as much as other products out there. So from our customer's perspective, it's more revenue, but for us, it runs hotter, it consumes parts, and it runs twice as much. It's terrific for our service business and a great opportunity. As Mark talked about from a FastWorks perspective, this is really a showcase product launch for us in the power business. Relative to the F, we've introduced this in half the time. Scaling up, we're ramping this product up from we built one last year, we'll build seven this year, and we'll have the capacity to deliver 30 in 2016. Doing that, how have we been able to do that? A lot of it is tied to the technology capability that you're going to see here today, the confidence in that, and our testing ability, which I have a slide on, which is unprecedented in the industry, and it's allowed us to do both 50 and 60 hertz simultaneously. Any power plant on Earth, this product can fit. What are the customers saying? Two years ago, we didn't have it in our catalog. We didn't have an air-cooled version of our H in our catalog. Here we are today. We have 45 gas turbine technologies selected and 15 that are in our orders backlog. Just to take a second, to build a billion-dollar power plant, there's a development cycle. What our customers will do is they'll work with our application engineering team and get to a point where they down select and say, "We're going to go with UGE." Then they go to get permits. They'll get their project sited and get the financing, and that will be when we'll book it as an order. 45 units are selected where we've been down selected as the technology of choice. 15 have reached their permit financial close and are moving forward in the build cycle. That 45 naturally becomes your next level of order book. We have 84 in current bid activity, a lot of excitement. You can see across the globe, not only in North America, but in eight or nine countries around the world, we've got commitments. How did we do this so fast in the spirit of FastWorks? A big part of it was the investment that we made in the world's only full-speed, full-load test facility. I look around the room, several of you I know have been down here. We've had over 200 customers in the last year visit this test facility as we've been testing our 9HA.01 in Greenville. What does it mean? When you take a turbine and you plug it into the grid, whether it's 60 hertz or 50 hertz, it has to be within a few tenths of a percent of that frequency. Otherwise, it gets kicked off the grid. You don't have the ability to run it through perturbations and issues that you'll see in the fleet when it's connected to the grid. Whereas here, with our full-speed, full-load facility, we can run a 60 hertz turbine at 50 hertz. We can run it at 65 hertz. We can stall the compressor. 200 hours of testing one unit gives us a distribution for the engineers that feels like 500 units running for a year. Historically, this industry would build a power plant, go a few years, build another one, go a few years, and you'd have a decade kind of introduction cycle. What would that do? That would allow your competitors to catch up and to make pivots. With this launch and the speed of this launch, it's a case of you get out in front, you stay in front, and you just build out the next generation of power plants. The other aspect which is interesting is in the bottom right, it's actual data, but the graphic is, you can see there's a red dot that shows this is what our engineers said for this particular parameter they felt the output and efficiency would be. You can see the actual blue dot is where the testing results have come. What this is doing is showing more output, more efficiency, and as a result, dealing with our customers relative to servicing those units, future upgrades, we can already see a path to how we play that in the market. This is giving our engineers the confidence and what we call internally the swagger, really to play a very aggressive move on the first generation of upgrades. That's where we are today. The whole concept of product management is the next step, the multi-generational product plans. You can see we're north of 61% with air-cooled technology, something that a decade ago was really more of a dream than it was a reality, and here we are today talking about it. We clearly have plans to get to 65 and north of 65, and leveraging the GE Store is critical to that. You'll hear from Bill Fitzgerald, a lot of great work on ceramic matrix composites for the latest aircraft engines. Putting that into our gas turbines gives us a nice bump. The advanced combustion and some of the advanced manufacturing tools are going to allow us to implement geometries that can really change the game on the ability to reduce NOx and then therefore push forward technology. Just the tool suite. the tool suite, the ability to design. Just to give you a perspective, if you go back just 5 years ago, to do some of the unsteady physics calculations, an engineer would launch a model and come back 10 days later, and it would be done. That's how long it would take just to calculate some of these complicated equations that you need to understand the unsteady aspects of some of these models. It's all about trying to get a molecule of air and a molecule of fuel and follow it through the engine with a level of precision that allows you to design to the next level of performance. That capability, it comes from the GE Store and continues to move us forward. Just to wrap up here, when you talk about new products, historically, we had a, you'd introduce a new product, the cost would be higher, and then you'd try to drive it down over time. With this mentality of doing slower introductions, you could argue that could be okay. Today, as you ramp up faster, it's a whole different headset in our business about cost, and it's really an all-out effort to drive costs down on two fronts. One, when we introduce a new product, we want the cost below where we've traditionally had it, and then how do you drive it down faster than we've done in the past? That takes three aspects. It takes design, it takes sourcing, and it takes manufacturing. We've implemented what we call life cycle centers of excellence, which your team is committed to doing this on new products and using the whole FastWorks theme, a tremendous amount of pivots earlier. Things in design, understanding the entitlement, so every piece of the power plant, dollars per pound, dollars per flow, dollars per megawatt, every subsystem has to buy its way on. From a sourcing perspective, we have just next week, we'll have nearly 100 suppliers in Schenectady, just 2 miles from here, where we're going to walk them through the H volume, the H build-out, and tell them, "This is a build-out cycle. You're with us or not, and here's what we need for our cost targets," and position that ahead of a lot of the costs coming into the business. Then on the manufacturing, Kristine talked about Brilliant Factory. Some numbers. Our HA launched 10% below our 7F.05, and we introduced the latest 7F.05 in 2010. This H product is 10% below the first one on a dollar per megawatt, where we were with that NPI just a few years ago. The 7F.05, just over the last 2 years, we've driven down 22%. Just in the next 12 months, we've got clear paths with POs to be able to drive the HA down 20%. We're confident not only with our market position, but our ability to drive productivity and cost and expand margins in the near term. Just to wrap here, gas, well-positioned to grow for the first time. It's the fastest-growing capacity and fuel energy generation source. We have the most comprehensive portfolio out there, the strongest catalog, and I think we've got an operational rigor to take a lot of the things you'll see today and put it into the business and on behalf of our customers. We're investing $2 billion. Like I said, this isn't a case of just one launch and try it. This is we're in, we're going to lead this space. That $2 billion is $800 million on engineering to design it. It's $600 million on our test facility, which some of you have seen, to validate and prove this technology out. It's $600 million with our supply chain to ramp it up to be able to build this at scale. With that, I'll turn it over to Bill Fitzgerald, who leads our aviation business.
Thanks, Vic. Good morning. As Vic said, I'm Bill Fitzgerald. I run the commercial engine business. I've been in the role now since 2011, and I've got 32 years of experience within GE, largely in operating roles in the last 5 years on the commercial side between the GEnx engine and now this role. The commercial engine business is an absolutely terrific business within the aviation portfolio. We've had a very healthy run of revenue growth over the last 3 years, about 22% increase. Similar to Vic's business, I sort of share the role of leading commercial business from the original equipment side with my partner, Kevin McAllister, who runs the services business. Combined, it's about a $17 billion enterprise. On the original equipment side, we've got very strong backlog here, actually record at $27 billion. We've got 13,000 engines that are already under contract to be built. We're in really a decade of product renewal and doing so profitably that started with the GEnx in the 2011 timeframe. Passport and LEAP will both go into service sometime over the next 18 months. Then our final upgrade is the GE9X, which will replace the 115B towards the end of the decade. Our technology imperatives are relatively straightforward, although large tasks. It's deliver the next generation of products and do it in the right profitable way. Secondly, it's industrialize those new technologies, make sure that those investments, we're not repurposing factories. We're actually investing. We've had five announcements in the last 3 years associated with technology-specific factories that are designed to help our supply chain be able to deliver that volume for growth. And then use some of the digital investments that Christine talked about for two things. One, to find targeted opportunities for supply chain productivity. And then secondly, to enhance the already very solid performance of our products. I have to say, it's a good time to be in the aviation space right now. The environment is strong. Passenger demand is growing and continues to grow. Utilization factors of those planes are stable. The cargo business is growing again. And jet fuel's on its way down, which is a very good thing for our customers. All of that is leading to probably the highest sustained profitability of the airline since the pre-deregulation days of the 70s. And as a result of that, as you can see from the production volume, airlines are investing. And when they're investing, they do like our product. And so we're really pleased with the fact that we've got so many orders there. And that feeds our services annuity stream in a very nice way. So between now and 2020, we'll be up to 46,000-47,000 engines out in the fleet that really helps us from an ability to go invest in a technology perspective. This business has had a rich history of picking the right products with the right airframers, and this generation of product development is really no different whatsoever. The thing I would highlight on this page first is we are the only engine OEM that plays in all three of the commercial markets, from wide body to narrow body to the regional. The second thing that I would highlight is six of the nine active offered aircraft we have sole source positions on. And the other three, we're north of 50% from a market share. So we've got some really strong interest in our products. If you take the narrow body, for example, we're sitting at a 54% market share from an Airbus product perspective, and of course, sole source on the 737 MAX at Boeing and the COMAC 919, that gives us a 79% market share from a LEAP perspective. So the interest in our product has been enormously strong, and we're delighted with the response to it. Now, you're familiar with the GE model of continuous innovation, and the aviation space is really no different. When we're sitting to decide what are we going to do for next product improvements, it's all about going to the customer because they ultimately determine our success. And going to listen. And no big surprise here, what are the customers telling us? They need fuel efficiency and reliability. They need margin to the regulatory standards of emissions and noise. And they'd like some help associated with owning and operating the asset. Well, we take all of that information and we come to the GE store. We come to Mark's toolbox of technologies and we say, what's here that we could go use to go deliver those assets, number one. And then number two, what's the operating cadence that we connect with Mark's team and the other technologists to make sure that we can bring those technologies to life and deliver those commitments to customers. And as a result, that's what differentiates our products from our competitors. So what I want to do now is kind of take you through a couple of examples, both at the product level and at the technology level associated with how this really works. Let's start with the GEnx. Entered into service in 2011 with leading-edge breakthrough technologies that made this asset 15% more fuel efficient than its predecessor. And even more important than that, about 3% more fuel efficient than its competitor. It's now flying at 19 different airlines. We've got 3 million hours worth of experience that's telling us that the technology and the architectures that we chose are delivering real values for our customers. We take that foundation of technology, and then we go listen to what the narrow body and the regional space told us, which is, look, we like that, but we run higher cycle assets, and we need to make sure that as we get that fuel efficiency, we're not paying for it in the form of maintenance cost. So we get the team together, we scale it, design for what the customers have told us, and the result of that is the LEAP and the Passport. And the early indication on the Passport, which the two architectures are similar, is we're about half a percent better from a fuel efficiency perspective than what we had designed for, and it gives us strong confidence that the LEAP architecture is the right architecture as well. Then again, we hear from the industry they like to see us upgrade the 115B, one of the industry standards, and we like the foundation, but we'd like to see higher thrust, and we think advanced materials are really required to make sure that we can hit about a 10% improvement in the fuel efficiency. That, again, come back to the GE store, work with the team, and when that product enters into service, it will be the highest efficiency jet engine in any class. More importantly, with a tremendous amount of confidence tied to the 60 million hours worth of experience out there, that this asset is going to delight the industry for the next 30 years. The other thing that comes along with this is some nice business efficiencies, because we do get engineering productivity. We do have the ability to reuse the manufacturing technologies, and that has created the capacity in this decade to have the largest number of commercial launches in our history. Let's take that down just a little bit further, and there's some terrific examples of the GE store, both giving and taking here, starting with the composite fan blade. We introduced the composite fan blade in the 1995 timeframe, but it wasn't really the first use of it. The first use of it actually was in 1980s, mid-80s, with our unducted fan application. When I talk about generational investments in technologies, a foundation that began in the 1980s that continues to reap benefit, that's what I'm talking about. The benefit of bringing the composite fan blade in here was we reduced 1,100 pounds of weight in the asset. We got much better durability. In fact, today it's the leading durability fan blade in the industry. We're the only one that has it, and it's unchallenged in that regard. We got fuel efficiencies as well. Now, as aeromechanics technologies advanced and as carbon fiber technologies advanced, we took advantage of that. We were able to improve the efficiency, reduce the number of parts, and when the GE9X engine enters service into 2020 with 16 blades, not the original 22, we'll be able to pull 3.5 million cubic feet per minute of air, or the equivalent capability of being able to evacuate the world's largest domed stadium of all air in about 30 seconds. The other thing that we got along the way was we learned, well, we could use this composite material in other places, like the fan case. Took out another 700 pounds on the GEnx alone, ended up with virtually a maintenance-free fan module for our customers. We took all that insight, put it back in the GE store, and the wind team came along and said, "Hey, if we could use that, we could take our weight down, we could increase the length of our blades by about 20 feet, and we could increase the power capability of these wind turbines by almost 20%." It's a terrific example of how can we work together for the benefit of the company and the customers. The second example I thought I'd talk about was ceramic matrix composites. Lots of dialogue on this. Some people think it started with aviation. It actually didn't start with aviation. Vic and the energy team and the F-turbines around the mid part of the last decade put it in the frame 7, and it's given us an awful lot of insight in terms of what we're capable of doing from an engine perspective. Just to clear, what does it enable for us? It enables twice the thermal capability at a third of the weight of the traditional metal pieces of hardware here. It's a game changer in terms of what it can accomplish from an efficiency perspective in the engine. We've got a totally vertically integrated supply chain here, all the way back to the fiber source, and not just for aviation, but aviation and the energy team as well. The second thing is we've dedicated a lean lab in Newark, Delaware. It's been there for about 10 years. That's totally focused on two things, producibility and product cost. There's a group of engineers that have been there dedicated to that, and then we picked that process up, and we put it in our new Asheville, North Carolina manufacturing facility, which was announced about 2 years ago and started producing parts about 6 months ago. We'll put the shroud in the LEAP asset first, and then the other items that are on that hardware, other hardware items that are on that chart, will end up in the GE9X engine. In fact, today, we're actually running all of those parts in a GEnx demonstrator engine, because one of the big focuses of our technology maturation process is to make sure that we are demonstrating this technology works in the environment that it's going to operate in. By the time the 9X goes into service, we'll have almost 2.5 million hours worth of real evidence that the technology is working and demonstrating value for our customers. The third area that I thought I'd talk about is compression technology. The heart of a turbofan engine is its core, and we've had a rich history over decades of developing the most efficient and stall-free compressors in the industry. We went to a new approach to this with the GEnx, with the use of Bliss technology and the powder metals on the aft end of the compressor. Pressure ratio is simply the pressure at the beginning of the compressor versus the pressures at the end of the compressor. How one compresses air in a smooth fashion is the key to the fuel efficiency of the core of the asset. With LEAP and Passport built on that capability, then when it came to the 9X, to deliver the fuel efficiency of the 9X, we need a 27-to-1 pressure ratio compressor. That's never been done before. We can do it, tied to the technology that Mark has given us, tied to the blade technology and powder metals. But being able to do it is one thing. Being able to demonstrate it's another. And one of the big advantages that we've had here is we built this first compressor like this about a year ago. We needed to test it. Actually, the only place in the world that could test it in essence, the environment it was going to operate in, was our GE oil and gas facility in Massa, Italy. So we plugged it in February 6th of last year, ran the compressor for 300 hours, demonstrated operability, demonstrated the aeromechanics, actually found that our fuel efficiency implications were a little better than were expected. We took it off, sent it back to the design engineers, modified it. We fired the second iteration of that about 4 weeks ago, and so we're going to get a little bit better from a fuel efficiency perspective, feeding the 10% increase in efficiency on the 9X versus the 115B. The last item I talk about is combustion technology. And we've been on a 20-year journey, but the journey really didn't begin with us. It began with the energy team that had worked on technologies to deal with NOx far earlier than we were dealing with it in the dual-engine combustor introduction in 1995. But two things have really changed the game in combustion for us tied to that foundation. One is the use of twin-annular pre-swirler technology, and the second one is the use of additive. Introducing additive here, starting with LEAP, gives us a 25% reduction in weight, allows us to go from 20 separate parts that needed to be brazed and welded down to one part. It gave our design engineers, in essence, a brand new canvas that they could work towards. And it gives us a 5X improvement in durability of those assets. So absolutely significant advantages to us. And it puts us and our customers in a position that their NOx generation is dramatically lower than any of our competitors. So now let's take it back up to the introduction of the product launch. I've showed you the four technologies that make this thing sing. We're delighted with the response of the customer base here. 79% market share. We've sold 8,600 engines at 60 customers. Now it's time to go deliver all of that. We're well on our way through the certification program. Now it's about taking the learnings that we got on the GNX program and how do we go accelerate the learning curve here to deliver from a cost perspective. This launch is different from other launches. We've got a dedicated new product introduction leader who's totally focused on delivering the performance parameters that we've committed contractually. From a schedule perspective, we're stress testing every aspect of our system, from customers and are they ready to deal with this technology, to our supply chain and our suppliers. We've got a dual source strategy for every aspect of our delivery so that not if there's an issue somewhere in the supply chain, but when there's an issue, we've got capacity that can deal with those issues. And then, you know, similar to Vic, we've got a laser focus around cost. We've got an enterprise-wide cost team specifically focused on these technologies. They meet on a weekly basis, complemented by 11 technology-specific lean labs that do nothing but focus on producibility and cost. And then from an engine should cost analysis perspective, as our sourcing teams are going out to negotiate with suppliers around the globe, making sure that they have the best tools available to know what these technologies should actually cost. So, you know, in summary, as I said, we're in the middle of a decade worth of product renewal in a profitable way. There is no question that we're the beneficiary of generational investments in technology. And I thank God and Mark every day for the GE store because it is helping us to do what we need to do for our customers and our shareholders. Thanks for the opportunity to talk, and I'd like to introduce Anders Wald.
Thanks, Bill. Good morning. I'm Anders Wald, and I run the ultrasound business. I came to GE through an acquisition when Jeff decided to be serious about ultrasound. That's 17 years ago, and it's been a fantastic journey. I'd like to share that with you today. And I also, if you didn't get it yet, my accent, I'm Norwegian. I run this business from Norway and basically own Bill's planes. Right? So make them reliable, right? So healthcare is a business to be very excited about. Not only do we have a great position, but from a technology point of view, we have so much in store. We build a fantastic momentum, and I'll talk a little bit about that today. Just as a way of example, last year we launched 40 different new products, NPIs. and that was like from 30 the year before. So there's a building momentum here, and showing out six of them here. All these six that I show here, CT, MR, ultrasound, all gained 5-10 points market share across the board globally. So brought a lot of growth and profit back to the business. That's one example how we're doing that. And I'll share a little bit more on ultrasound, because ultrasound is going to be probably a little bit of a template of how we're going to run this business going forward. But before that, from a technology and imperative point of view, the market is definitely changing quite a bit. So customers are not necessarily looking for just buying another box and a better image today. They're looking for outcomes. There's a lot of economic pressure in this market. On top of that, we want to accelerate, so we really want to put in a much faster speed. So we're forcing the market to replace faster. That's another key imperative to what we do here. On the cost side, we want to drive much more gross margin into the business here. And so we're taking cost out from an engineering point of view, looking at materials, low-cost designs and things like that. And of course, we launch NPIs with these higher rates, gives us an opportunity to also be more competitive from a price position and access to value markets, for instance. Another platform that we're working hard on that's going to be very important going forward is to make them software-enabled. Think about the analytics story, how we're going to make remote access to customers, installs, and provide a whole different level of being distributed in our health approaches. So that's going to be productive for customers and for ourselves. And big data is going to be a major part of that going forward in some of our businesses. And finally, on service, we have a huge service business today. It's a lot of focus to get the margins up in this area. Software offerings is going to be important as we are connected. We will enable new packages to drive that as well. So that's basically where we put our bets in terms of R&D. And GRC is for healthcare. Because we are so diverse, this is really the GE story. Because with so many different hundreds of products, there is no need to replicate all of that in our centers. So we have a core focus to get a lot of the basics, the core piece done at GRC. So that's one piece. In addition to that, of course, as we grow and we want to go to adjacent markets, that's a lot of long-term investments, special ones, some examples highlighted here, whether they are in the MR or in the CT business or even in the ultrasound business. If we didn't have those technologies, we'll be in less competitive situation in the marketplace. So another great advancement here at the center or in other centers around the world. The other area, which is really looking long-term for healthcare. Today, healthcare is very much at the hospital level. But we expect that to be much closer to consumers as we go, as each of us are very, very differently. Today, the treatment is happening by basically diagnostics based on some symptoms. That's not a very good approach today in healthcare. You should absolutely think about yourself as a unique individual, and as you get sick, you get even more unique. So it has to be very, very personal. And we want to have systems, processes, and equipment that are able to address that, going from symptoms to personal signatures, looking at yourself. And that's one piece. Brain is another one. And of course, digital health, I think about digital health as distributed health. You want to get outside of the hospital, be much more connected, and reach more at a lower cost. So that's those trends. The GRC is very focused on that, and we need to have that kind of contribution into our businesses. Now, let me take you through some of the ultrasound businesses, because that's the foundation for what we're going to do and change healthcare, GE healthcare, a little bit going forward, and looking at growth and growth on top line as well as the margin. So the ultrasound history is going back to 1995. There's nothing. 200 million, really no margin, not serious about it. And Jeff decided to go after a couple of acquisitions. That was the foundation. 3 years later, maybe 500 million. And after that, we had 10% growth every year, and it's continuing in many ways. So how did we do that? We looked at this business to be truly global. Global in the right sense. We are present in more than 150 countries today. Okay? We have more than 40 products, so we cover all applications and all price points. With that depth and breadth, you are everywhere. You're thinking of every customer. There's no other competitor today is doing that. They're focusing on high-end or some specific application or in the low end, et cetera. That helps us big time, but by that approach. We have more than 10 different centers that helps out with that, very proximate to markets, learn about the markets, create a little bit of internal competition to make certain that we get the best of everything. That's the foundation to do that. We are in a leading position technology-wise with customers. Our market share are by far we at 2014 were a $2.5 billion business in a $6 billion market. The ultrasound market has now become the biggest imaging modality market today, the biggest and the fastest growing. That's a very interesting investment from 1995 to 2014. Another element, because we have this breadth and depth and the engineering teams, we can launch more than 10 different products every year. That's another piece that's very, very important because you can compare this business with an electronics business. How often do you change your phone, right? This is electronics, so we have to renew it. With 10-15 products NPIs every year out of a portfolio about 40, we turn around the portfolio every second and third year. That creates a lot of headaches for competition, great for customers in the way that they like it, enjoy it, but they're also forcing replacement cycles. It's a very, very good engine, and that's the key part of the success. On top of that, we have put a mantra in for the teams. You do cost out first before you do your NPIs. We have a track record of about 10% cost out of every product every year as we go along. Don't introduce a single product if it has to be lower all the time. That in itself has driven massive margins into the business and also brought us to different price points as products have become from big systems to smaller systems. As image quality, you look at the image at the left on top here, you have to have a pretty good imagination what that is. It is pretty clear what the fetus is in 2015. That's what you see today, and that's what you get today. With that, we have seen that this market, you can segment it out. It could be on different levels, whether you're in cardiology or radiology or obstetrics, gynecology. These are very different ones. You have different systems, different technology to get there. Learning from this has brought us to different levels. I'll just show you a little bit of where we stand today in terms of images today and keep you a little bit out of your financials, right? Up at the left-hand side here, you could see twins, 6 weeks old twins. This is the state-of-the-art today, launched Q4 last year. This product was the VolumeStone V10, and it sold $130 million in fourth quarter alone in itself. A blockbuster of a product, and patients are demanding this now. Not our hospitals, but the patients because they want to see those images. You can see the fetus there on top there. Down left is a cardiac image, maybe less compelling from that perspective, but very, very important. It's a fantastic technology. DRC has been intimately involved in that development. You could see a four-chamber heart, valves opening, shutting. You see it in two planes on the left-hand side, and you see a 3D or like a 4D representation live here, and it's all happening real time. That's the value of ultrasound today versus MR, CT, all these other, which you have to take the image and then go back and look. This happens at the patient's side, and you can make a diagnosis right there. It's safe, no radiation, easy to use, portable, low cost, all these different things, which drives this imaging modality with strong growth today. Very, very preferred in the early stage of a diagnostic cycle. That's one area that we want to keep driving. The other one would be the cost piece here, the gross margin area. How do we do this? We've been driving the gross margin. It's really a very rich margin business today. You would think, why would it be? Because we have all this low-cost equipment, and it's plenty of competitors. Why would we be in this situation? It's relentless focus and a culture to drive out cost to bring us to a lower price point all the time. Sourcing is, of course, like we heard from the earlier presenters here, there's a lot of strategic alignments, making certain that we have full focus on that and then following the electronics industry Moore's Law is fundamental in this business. Then we utilize these suppliers and work with them to make certain we get to the lowest price and cost point. Value engineering is another key element. Before we do the NPI, we have to take out the cost. So we have hundreds of projects, and it's interesting to have many different plants at this stage, because then you have a little bit, so we can play with different plants to make certain that you have the best cost out solution, whether it's by design or some other way. So that's another key thing of that. The other piece is that I talked about 10 to 15 NPIs every year. That's the fast work cycle. We can do that. So we don't make many big bets and many small ones and make certain we're accurate all the time. So that keeps a much faster pace in terms of getting this launched, and we can test them out. And finally, today, the market is like most electronics, you expect durability. We don't, as a company, expect to have any cost of the launch of product. We expect only returns. So we can't have products failing. So we really developed them with a high level of reliability. So that the new wave of this one was in ultrasound, 2x reliability. Now we're looking at 4x reliability. In fact, we offer for all our value products today more than 3 years of warranty, for instance. So it's a good customer protection as well. So just to make certain you kind of get this on, what we would try to do in healthcare now and look at what happened in ultrasound. So we took all the big systems and made them smaller by weight, by size, by portability, by addressing all customers, and all customers globally, and by application. So that's the key, and that needs to happen in all the other parts of healthcare as well. Look at the entire breadth and depth of going after every customer. So to do that, the foundation is to really do customer-backed R&D all the time. So that's the key part of success. The second one will be the product cost out, and we'll see much more of that going forward. I think we have a pretty good plan. And the cardinal rule, do the cost out before we do the product development in terms of NPI. So that's another shift of gear and what we want to do. And then, of course, do it fast. Do it fast all the time. And I think that's going to help us in the healthcare industry to force customers and the market to replace even faster. So that will be another foundation for us. And the ultrasound success story is built on these three things, and that's where we're going to take the rest of healthcare. So with that, I think we are having a break.
Yes, so folks, we'd like to introduce a quick 10-minute break, so please get refreshed and be back in your seats in 10 minutes, and we'll go on with the next part of the program. Thank you.
Friday night, I'm going nowhere. All the lights are changing, green to red. Turning over TV stations, situations running through my head. Looking back through time, you know it's clear that I've been blind. I've been a fool to open up my heart to all that jealousy, that bitterness, that ridicule. And if you want it, come and get it. Crying out loud, the love that I was giving you was never in doubt. Let go of your heart, let go of your head, and feeling now. Let go of your heart, let go of your head, and feeling now. Show you how I really
Amen. Hold on to me as we go, as we roll down this unfamiliar road. And although this wave is stringing us along, just know you're not alone, 'cause I'm gonna make this place your home. Settle down, it'll all be clear. Don't pay no mind to the demons, they fill you with fear. The trouble in my drag you down. You get lost, you can always be found. Know you're not alone, 'cause I'm gonna make this place your home. Thank you.
Folks, if you could take your seats, please. We'd like to get started again, please.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. Welcome back, everyone. My name's Joe Mastrangelo. I lead the power conversion business, which is the former Convertim acquisition that's part of the energy management business. I've been in my position since 2011 when the acquisition closed. Prior to that, I was in the oil and gas business. When you look at my 22 years with GE, I've actually spent the majority of it working outside of the U.S. across various parts of the energy value chain. What I wanted to do this morning is start off with a discussion around where we think we stand as far as power conversion and how we started. I think the first thing I would tell you from the investment that we made in Convertim almost 4 years ago, we got a great product portfolio and a great technology base and great technologists as part of this business, and I'll show you some of that technology here this morning and then also explain to you about how we bring value across other G businesses. But I'll start off first with talking about how we grow the gross margins in this business and how we get this to be a well-performing GE platform. Now, when you start off and look at the early signs being extremely positive, if you look at our equipment backlog, which now stands at $3 billion, that's double of what the backlog was when we acquired the company. And a couple things that I would tell you about is how we shifted this portfolio. When we purchased the company, it was a predominantly European-based company. Today, the majority of our orders come from outside Europe in the areas that are growing their consumption of energy. The second piece I would say is we've gone through and made significant investments in really three main areas in this business to help improve performance. The first one is we built a service business and doubled its size since acquisition, but that doubling in size still only captures about a third of the opportunity, so there's more room to grow. We've improved the fulfillment capability in the business, and I'll talk a little bit about that later on in my slides. And then the last piece was driving efficiency in how we operate the business and in how we fit into the overall GE portfolio. What I'd like you to do as you listen to me talk this morning is to think back to the presentations we heard before the break and realize that all the knowledge that you hear from the people who talked this morning, one, I have access to, and two, I've brought other great people in from GE into this business to help us accelerate the learning curve and get this investment to deliver the return that you deserve as investors in the company. Let me now say why do we feel the power conversion technology is important to GE? This is a chart that, depending on what you use, you've heard all these different statistics before around the overall energy value chain. But I want to spend a few moments talking about what it means to me as the leader of the power conversion business. You know, with electricity demand forecasted to grow, the one thing I would tell you is 45% of the electricity consumed in the world ends up on an electric motor. That's one of the core products that we have inside our business. You heard Vic talk earlier about off-grid power and also renewables. we have technology that I'll share with you today that allow us to optimize the performance of that. What we do as a business is we manage the intersection of the grid, the off-grid, and the industrial process with great technology and software that allows you to drive efficiency into the business. On the efficiency point, when you look at the future energy demands, if we don't gain the efficiency that you see in this chart, the demand of energy goes up four times what we're forecasting today. Two of the main drivers of that efficiency gain ties to the technology and power conversion. First one is right-sizing your electrical components to the duty that you need in your industrial process. Many of the applications that you see today, whether you're talking about a refinery, a steel mill, a food processing plant, have fixed-speed technology. What that means is basically you turn the motor on, and the motor runs at a speed regardless of the power required by your industrial process. We have the technology that allows you to manage that variation and reduce the consumption to increase industrial output. So it's a technology suite that fits well across the entire energy value chain. And when you look at what we do as a business, we basically do three things. The first one is we take motion and turn it into electricity. So think about a wind farm or a hydro dam. We take the power of that motion and generate efficient electricity. The second thing we do is we take electricity and turn it into electricity. Now, what does that mean? Give you two examples. The first one is, if you think about a rail, an electric rail grid, that grid operates at a different frequency than your power grid. We have the technology that allows rail companies to both utilize power from the grid or sell power back into the grid in an efficient manner. The second example that I would give you is on offshore platforms, where an offshore platform is essentially, on average, between $100 and $140 million microgrid, and I'll show you an example later in the presentation about how we help those operate more efficiently. The third thing that we do as a business is we take electricity and turn it into motion. Electricity turned into motion, it's a motor or a generator hooked up to a propeller on a ship, a compressor in an oil and gas application, or pumps in a water desalination application. So we go across the entire value chain with essentially two products. First one is motor and generator, so rotating equipment, very similar to what you heard Bill and Vic talk about this morning. And then the second piece is we have drives, which are power electronics equipment, very similar to what Anders talked about in the ultrasound space. We take those two pieces of technology, combine them together with software to create integrated systems to drive efficiency and production across the value chain. The third piece, which is the piece that we're building as GE, and when you hear Rafael's presentation after me, you'll see an example of how we can bring this into our businesses. We do these in offshore applications, high-altitude mining applications, areas that are difficult, so we can bring the delivery and tap into the already pre-existing service and resources that we have around the world as GE to improve the performance of our business. But in a whole, when you look at power conversion is a business with broad domain expertise that improves the efficiency of industrial applications. What I'd like to do in the next part of the presentation is spend a couple of minutes talking about two core technologies that enable us to do this. The first one is around electric motor technology. So electric motors, you basically have two types of electric motors. This is an induction motor. As of this morning, I got an email from our team, the facility that Bill talked about in Maasa. We passed the test for the largest induction motor ever built in the industry this morning. Now, that moment of serendipity has a lot behind it that has to do with the GE store. So when you think about these electric motors, you would kind of say to yourself, what would an electric motor have to do with an aircraft engine or a gas turbine or a compressor? That rotor that you see in the electric motor spins at the exact same speed as an aircraft engine. So as you're trying to increase size of the motor, you're trying to increase the speed of the rotor to reduce the size that you have, the footprint, to increase your power density. We were able to go into the aviation team and pull their engineers in to help us with the rotor dynamics of that to allow us to scale up from a traditional induction application, which is usually between 10 to 14 megawatts, to deliver a 20-megawatt application. But then out of that rotor dynamics, we then came here to the GRC to look at bearing technology to improve the stability of how the motor performs. And then knowing that many of these motors wind up in offshore applications, That purple piece that you see in the upper right, that foundation of the motor, was a direct design that we took from Rafael's business in Florence that allowed us to reduce the footprint and weight offshore. Now, why is that so important? If you think about this product in and of itself, if we can reduce the size, increase the power density, you've got to think about what the customer is buying from you is the ability to reduce the space that they need, the steel structures that they need. If it's an onshore application, the size of the foundations and the civil works that they need. So it makes the overall application much more efficient and effective from a cost standpoint on a CapEx side. And an operating side, it operates much more efficiently. Now, the next step that we're working on is going back to that test facility that Bill talked about this morning. We're developing an 80-megawatt induction motor to run at the test bench in MASA. We get two things out of that. One, Rafael gets productivity because the tests that we'll run for oil and gas will cost less because we'll consume less energy. And the second thing is we'll have the largest, highest referenced induction motor in the world. Now, where do these applications apply? You can see they apply in marine, in pump jet applications. They apply in tidal applications, and we use them both in oil and gas and power generation. So it creates efficiency for the customer. It's a step-out technology, but when you step out technology with millions of hours of operating experience, you know that when it gets out in harsh environments, it's going to run to specification. The second piece I would talk about is switching to the capabilities of our applications interacting with the software COE to improve the performance of our customers. So I want to spend a moment on the upper left-hand side of the chart around the power reliability. This is an example of a 140-megawatt offshore power grid application. It's a floating production unit with a drilling rig, and it has a combined microgrid between the two locations. What we do as a business is allow those two platforms to interact with one another. So depending on the loads on each platform, you vary the production of the gas turbines to reduce the operating cost. Now, offshore, when you're operating, the last thing you want is a blackout. So we've gone through and tested multiple failure modes to make sure that if any of you in the last second blinked your eye while I was talking, our ability to stop a blackout will be 10 times faster than an eye blink, 40 milliseconds. It's proven technology simulated both in the software COE here at the GRC and in our business. That technology applies across, if you look at the upper right-hand side, that's an example from an arc furnace operation in metals or goes down into a renewables farm, solar farm hookup into the grid. Now, on the bottom left, I want to spend a moment talking about that because you saw and heard Mark talking about FastWorks and the software COE. If you want to see where the PowerPoint goes into reality, take a moment after the session today, go outside to the solution fair, and you'll see the product right in front of you. You'll be able to play with it. You'll be able to simulate docking a boat. And it's a fantastic solution that we started working on in the fall of 2012. We introduced it at OTC in the spring of 2013, and we passed sea trials, and we have vessels out running with the equipment on it today. What you'll see when you look at this equipment is what we brought was the domain expertise from our business of how ships operate, and what the software COE brought was the ability to allow the captain to control the vessel and also operate the vessel in a more effective and efficient manner. So it's a real example of FastWorks combined with domain expertise of the business and the software COE driving value and better outcomes for our customers. Now, when you take this technology, I now want to spend a moment talking about how we tie into different industries across the energy value chain. I want to spend a moment talking about renewables. So on the left-hand side of the page, spend a second talking about offshore wind. This is a product that we developed with Alstom that went back prior to the Convertim acquisition as becoming part of GE. But what we were able to do is increase the reliability of the world's largest permanent magnet generator by coming here to the GRC and working on both our magnet design, which is a direct flow down from what we get out of our healthcare business, and also our structural designs to make sure that the efficiency of the turbine works. The second piece that we have is this 1.5 kV power converter. Now, this is a big deal in the renewables industry because the majority of the converters in renewables are 1 kV. Now, The simplest way to think about the difference between 1 kV and 1.5 kV is to think about a hose and water. Imagine you could take the same size hose and double the amount of water that you can put through it. This converter allows you to put more power point to point than traditional converters. So what we can do with 2 units is what it takes our competition to do with 3 units. Now, this 1.5 kV power converter was technology that we brought from our marine business that we then brought into wind that we then moved over and applied to solar. So if you look at the upper right-hand side on the solar side, we've introduced a 1.5 kV inverter line. This is critical because what happens with the 1.5 kV product is you reduce the amount of copper that you need in a solar farm. So if you think about the amount of money you'd have to spend to increase the efficiency of the panels, you gain that back by having a bigger inverter with the ability to flow more electricity through it in the short term. Now, it doesn't stop there. There's another example that you can see out in the solutions fair, which is around silicon carbide power devices. Now, this is the next evolution. And if you look at the bottom right, the 2 pictures that you see are scale pictures of the core power device for a solar inverter. So what we're doing is we're moving from a power electronics application down into a silicon carbide module. It allows you to handle higher heat. It allows you to reduce the number of losses. It increases the power density of the inverter, which again reduces the amount of copper that you need in the solar farm. So it makes the solar farm both more efficient and more cost-effective with higher reliability. So this is how our business brings cost-effective performance to the renewables industry. Now, the next one I want to spend a few seconds on is around marine and oil and gas. So I spent some time talking to you about the marine applications of how we work on powering offshore platforms, the propulsion that we do for large LNG carriers and for freight vessels. On the positioning piece, I gave you an example that I'd like you to go out and see. Now, on this positioning and propulsion piece, I showed a picture earlier on of a podded propulsion for an offshore service vessel. That induction motor technology was actually combined with impeller technology from the oil and gas business to increase the efficiency of how ships operate. Now, on the oil and gas side, you'll hear more about what Rafael does. And what we do as a business is we help Rafael's solutions become more efficient and have higher power density and become more cost-effective. But outside of that, when you look at where the technology goes, the 2 biggest things are the bottom part of that right-hand side of the page. The ability to integrate the mechanical solution, the ability to have a sister company that knows the gas composition or the oil composition coming out of the well, how you handle that mechanically, how that mechanical handling, what the power requirements are, and how the 2 of us together can tune that to make a more efficient oil and gas production application. And then the last piece is being able to incorporate that in with the capability that we have in Florence to do modules, which allows us to do the electrical brain nervous system of the overall power management. We now have the capability to do that in module-based construction, which reduces the risk on the project and also the overall cost for the end customer. So this is ways that we bring to both marine and oil and gas true customer productivity. Now, coming back to the gross margin expansion, you know, one of the biggest challenges that we had when we acquired Convertim was on the left-hand side of the page. The business was running at the time with an on-time delivery rate of around 25%. We've doubled the output and tripled the output across most of our factories, and our on-time delivery is now in the low 90s with a path to get up to the high 90s around delivery. We were able to do that. And how do you double and triple production? If you go back to the business has only been part of GE for about 3.5 years. How do you do that in such a short time frame? Is again, you reach into the GE stores and you bring people over that have done this in other parts of GE to help teach the people that come into GE as part of the acquisition to improve the performance. But outside of the physical factories, which we're very proud of, we're also able to bring in other areas of expertise. So go back to my example on the motor example. What we were able to do is to plug into pre-existing engineering centers in Mexico and Poland and drive both increase the capability of our engineers and drive down the engineering cost per hour to be able to develop the product. And then on top of that, when you think about what do you mean by simplification, when we bought the company, we had over 300 discrete engineering design tools. Having 300 discrete engineering design tools across a small business creates design proliferation inside your business. So you have a lot of different model numbers and a lot of engineering drawings, which then makes it difficult to go back and get volume buy, sourcing savings, increase the quality, and also drive productivity on the factory floor. We've now got that down to around 30, and we want to drive it down to single digits, and that allows us to really start sharing globally how the business interacts versus having it be a small regional business. Then around manufacturing technology, what you heard about this morning, our factories are a long way from being a brilliant factory, but we've got the roadmap that will get us there. And I think that's one of the most important things of being able to pull in the technology. And the last piece is you heard Vic talk about integrated testing capabilities for the H-turbine. It's a core competency in our oil and gas business, and we're building that same competency here in power conversion. When you add up the investment that we've made, we're looking at being able to add 5 points of gross margin over 3 years to the business as we go forward. So when you take that and you come back to the three key drivers that we look at, electrification growing, diversification microgrids, and energy efficiency, we've got the technology, we've got the capability around systems with great people. We can expand gross margins by better managing the overall designs and how we structure our products. And the goal is to be able to is that we're going to build a GE platform that we're proud of that delivers the returns that you expect as an investor in the company. So thanks for your time listening. I'll turn it over to Rafael Santana.
Thank you, Joe. So hey, good morning. I lead the Turbo Machinery business. I've been with the company for 15 years now, and only 3 of them in the U.S., all 12 outside. With that, let me start with we had a very strong 2014 in the business. We expanded both our market share, but we expanded also our profitability in the business. And with that, we've been able to expand by more than 7% our backlog. It has positioned us well in an industry that during that time frame, it was declining. So you look into 2014, it was coming down on anywhere between 5%-10%. With that, we continue to see some of challenges in the industry, and there's 3 areas that I want to highlight to you in terms of well focus areas for us. Number one, I think we've been working closer than ever before with customers, and it's been an effort on helping them on getting more out of existing assets. I'm going to talk to you later here about our upgrades business. It's been a great history of success on helping customers through technology to get more out of those existing assets. The other piece has been around speed to market, guaranteeing projects are delivered on time, which brings me to the second point here, which is the excellence in execution. We've been shortening our delivery cycles. They're down. Our on-time delivery across our product lines, they are in the mid to high 90s, and we continue to improve there. Back last year, we started a very intensive cost-out program and variable cost productivity in the business, and that's delivering us great results. And when I think about cost-out, I think one of the key parts of this program has been around allowing engineers, but also allowing buyers to have should-cost tools that better allow them to design for cost, but also whenever you're negotiating, to be better equipped to drive those. With that, the last point I want to bring up to you here is we're very proud of the NPIs we've been doing. That's opening up for us some great spaces that we didn't have before. I think one piece I would highlight to you is Nova LT16. This is a 16.5-megawatt turbine that opens up a billion-dollar equipment space for us this year, something we didn't have the year before. So we launched this September last year. And when I look at the play we're running, it feels good, and we feel like we've got a good portfolio here to partner with customers, help them maximize on the returns. And when I look at this portfolio, it's a portfolio that expands itself across what I'll call the gas infrastructure value chain. We're very much focused on upstream and midstream. And when you think of the various applications we go into, this is about compressors and compressor modules and power generation modules that we'll support customers on reinjection of gas, and we do that onshore and offshore. We also go into the LNG business, an important part of our business. We do that offshore as well with the floating LNG and pipelines, a key piece of our business. Important here, when we're serving customers on those various spaces, we have the opportunity to tap into technology that comes from GE, from, again, aviation, technology that comes from the energy management side of the house, technology that comes from power and water, which makes more than $1 billion that we're able to pull through, which brings, again, a great advantage to us. An advantage that we need when we look at some of the challenges our customers are facing. When I think of those challenges, there's still challenges on making sure you're on time on your projects, to your own cost, and there you're maximizing and monetizing the fuel opportunity you have out there. When we think of those challenges, I think one aspect is some recent surveys out there continue to indicate more than 70% of the time some sort of delays through various projects. When you think on cost, the complexity tied to some of the solutions out there, they have certainly increased. Just as an example here, as you look into the topside weight, it has grown by more than four times on offshore platforms. With that, there continues to be opportunities to monetize gas that's being flared and not fully utilized. I thought about here sharing with you some of the examples on how we're helping customers through that. The first one here, it's been around modules. Think if you could reduce by more than 15% the cycle time to deliver a solution to your customer. Think that at the same time you do that, you could reduce the complexity and the risk of having to build entire plants on very remote sites. Think if you could do that by engineering, manufacturing, and fully testing those solutions prior to them ever getting to site. You heard here a lot about the MASA. That's the world's largest full-stream test facility in the world, and we've developed that in the course of the last 4 years. This is a big part of our business. We've been growing scope as we do modules as well, and it's a big part of our last 4 years' growth. On offshore, we've had the opportunity to partner with customers like Total. You heard here from Joe, both footprint and weight drive a large piece of the cost tied to offshore solutions. We've been able to reduce by more than 20% over the last 4 years, the weight and footprint on those solutions. We got back into markets where we didn't really play before. It's also been an area we continue to make progress. The last picture you've got here is a picture out of Iraq. This is an opportunity where we've taken on a project where we've really taken on a wing-to-wing approach on the rehabilitation of some compression stations. Gas that was being before flared is now going to be transported, so it generates energy. Because we took, I'd say, more scope out of this, we've been able to reduce cost, reduce time for our customers, and we're bringing in technology with turbines that are going to be more efficient to do that. When you think of the technology needed to do a lot of those things, I think the great piece here is getting those from inside the GE store. Take, for instance, our power and water business. When you think of Statoil moving in Norway from shallow water into deep water offshore exploration and the need to have, again, optimized the footprint and weight for those solutions, that led us to introducing the LM6000, which is very much an aviation product, into this application. That has allowed them, again, optimizing footprint and weight, maximizing returns here for the project. It doesn't stop there. Freeport LNG, that's the very first electric LNG plant in North America. That's a project we won last year, a project that if I go back 3 years ago, I would have to gone to one of my competitors in order to purchase 50% of the content here. Well, I'm able to do that. I do it with Joe and his team. We won this project, and we moved from being fundamentally an equipment supplier to a turnkey provider. It's a big win for us. We haven't stopped here. Nova LT16, we're very excited about this turbine. It opens up, again, a $1 billion space that we can go and quote this year. We've already have some orders for it. This was not just about designing the best turbine out there on its class range. It was also about having the best-in-class cost, and I think that's how we've been positioning ourselves here. A couple points I want to highlight. It's how we got to this turbine. If you look at the FastWorks framework that we applied here, that allows us to get there in 30 months, something that would have taken us 5 to 7 years before. We've had the should cost tools here applied. We feel like we're in a very good position here to drive, again, incremental opportunities for us to grow the business. In closing, I'd say turbo machinery, that has been really a core piece of our oil and gas portfolio. It's been with GE more than 20 years now. So as part of the Nuovo Pignoni acquisition, it's a business that we've grown in size by more than sixfold. If you look at the profit rate, we've grown it by more than 3 times. It's a business that's got a history on executing through cycles. We have been growing it. We're running a very strong play in terms of optimizing our costs for the business. And we continue to really invest in new technology that has really positioned us well to drive profitable growth in challenging times in oil and gas. Thank you. With that, let me introduce Tina Donikoski.
Great. Thanks, Rafael. Good morning, everyone. I'm Tina Donikoski with our transportation business, where I lead global locomotives. I've been in this role for just a little over 2 years, but that is not a typo on your charts. I'm closing in on 4 decades with GE, and all of it in GE Transportation. So you'll need to pardon me if I can't dampen my enthusiasm and passion for my business, because it's going to come through. Okay, let's get started. 2015 will be a great year for us in transportation due primarily to the strong orders performance we saw last year. In fact, we had a record year for orders. We booked $9.6 billion in orders, largely due to our investment in technology. We ended last year with $6 billion in equipment backlog, which was over 2x as big as that number was a year ago. So that's why it is a great time to be at GE Transportation. This year, we'll launch our Evolution Series Tier 4 locomotive. We will be first to market, and we have been approved by the EPA, which pretty much is our first technology imperative. We want to lead with products and technology, not only in the railroad industry, but in mining and marine as well. We then take those products, take them to our services business, marry data and analytics, as you've heard from everyone else, and deliver great customer outcomes. And finally, our investment in those platforms and that technology allows us to grow globally, as we have in places like Australia, Indonesia, Kazakhstan, and Brazil. So that's how we think about our technology strategy. Now let me take you deeper into the technology itself. If you were to go deep inside the locomotive, take an MRI of the locomotive, you would find the vital organs. You would find the diesel engine, the heart. You would find control and power electronics, the brain and the nervous system. You would find traction motors and an alternator, the muscles. And you would put all of that together with system strength and software, and you'd have a locomotive. But that's not all. Our investment in those vital organs allows us to grow other products and other markets. The Tier 4 engine itself will not only be launched in locomotives, we've received the first 3 orders to put that engine in a marine application for offshore supply vessels. So it wasn't a brand new engine either that we had to do for Tier 4. Our investments in this platform date back to 2005 when we first came up with the Evolution Series. And that investment has seen us through Tier 2, Tier 3, and now Tier 4. Now that's not to say that hitting Tier 4 is any small putt. Hitting Tier 4 is a big technology challenge. When the EPA came out with the regulations for Tier 4 way back in 2008, they said you had to meet that requirement by 1/1/15. To meet that requirement, you had to reduce the emissions 70% from Tier 3, 70% reduction in NOx and particulate matter. Now, it was commonly believed at that time that the way you would accomplish this is through the use of after-treatment with urea. Urea is an ammonia-like substance used to clean diesel exhaust. Now, it's also commonly thought that in order to scale, this technology was used in automotive and on-highway, this after-treatment in urea. But when you scale from a car to a locomotive, that after-treatment winds up being a 4,000-pound structure that sits on top of the engine. It's like an SUV sitting on the engine, sitting on top of the locomotive. Nonetheless, we started down this technology path because we had to meet emissions by 1115. And as we got a little more mature in our concept and design, we started to talk to our customers, who told us in no uncertain terms they wanted nothing to do with urea. Now, why did they say that? They said it because they didn't want to handle another substance potentially hazardous on the railroad, and they also recognized that dealing with urea would cause them to spend $1.5 billion in their industry on infrastructure to deal with that. So now it was time to pivot, as they say in Fastworks. We had to come up with a Tier 4 compliant locomotive without after treatment in urea. Well, as you heard every other presenter say, we went right to the GE store. We called our friends in aviation who understand how to maximize that last drop of efficiency. We called our friends in power and water. They burn a lot of fuel, as you heard Vic say, and they understand combustion. We called our friends in oil and gas who helped us with our turbochargers. And finally, we come here to Global Research, where the technicians and the PhDs and the technologists have helped us for the last 15 years on our engine technology. We got all of these extremely smart technical folks together, and we used a process we call red team, blue team. We say to one team, you come up with the best design and maximize simplicity and cost. To the other team, you focus on value and efficiency. And then we're going to pick the best design from each of you, the best design, we're going to let you guys compete. Gee, people love a competition, so that was all good. In essence, we took parts of both designs. That's how we were able to achieve Tier 4 compliance without after treatment and urea. Now, I'll tell you that that happened back in 2010, that red team, blue team. And we continued our investment 11, 12, 13. And these are sizable investments. In the entire EVO platform, we've invested $600 million. In Tier 4 alone, we will have invested $200 million. There's no way a business of our size could manage that level of investment. That's why we're part of the bigger GE. Together, we can invest in technology like that and bring it to the market. So now let me fast forward for you. It's the beginning of 2014. We've continued our investment. We're bringing up our new Fort Worth facility to make locomotives. We've started a second engine site to remanufacture engines. And again, we go back to our customers. After all, we only have less than a year before the launch. Our customers tell us they don't need any locomotives for 2015. They aren't seeing the demand. They can wait out this new development. In fact, one customer told our CEO, "I suggest you stop investing. Slow that down. We don't need it." So again, we took a deep breath, but we persevered. And something happened from the beginning of 2014. The market changed. Through the tough winter of 2014, railroads took a big hit in velocity, which is their key metric. That's throughput for them. At the same time, they saw their demand start to increase. Demand for transporting crude, intermodal with the U.S. economy improving, grain. There were headlines that they were worried the grain would rot in the field before it could get to processing. Suddenly, our customers were facing a lack of power. But we were there for them. By the time 2014 ended, three things became very apparent. Number one, we were sold out of our 2014 capacity. They needed power, and they needed it right away, and we were able to give it to them. The second thing, our competitor announced at that time they would not have a Tier 4 product until 2017. They've since revised that to say, well, maybe the second half of 2016. The final thing that happened, our customers rewarded our investment with over 1,000 Evolution Series Tier 4 locomotives for delivery from 2015 through 2017. The year ended very differently than it began. There was no time to pop the champagne cork and high-five each other. Now it was time to get down to business. We have to focus on execution. First, technically, we want to make sure our Tier 4 locomotive runs exactly as customers need it to. We've had five prototypes out running all of 2014, learning, going through tunnels, through hot weather, through cold weather. They'll be joined by 15 more pre-production units this quarter. We learn from those units. Our railroad chief mechanical officers are very interested in this launch. We meet with them bimonthly, let them know what's going on. Likewise, as you heard everyone else say, we're laser-focused on our cost for this product. We know the cost of our pre-production, and we have line item detail walking that cost to our production cost. Lucky for us, we have volume, and we've made the most of that. We've had two suppliers for every critical part, and we were able to go along with those suppliers and take advantage of that competition. You'll hear Dan talk right after me about managing the critical X's. Our critical X's are labor, material, and design out. We want to have that all ready at the time of launch. Now, none of this would be possible without the right team in place to execute. We've done this launch a little differently. We drafted top talent from every single function, engineering, sourcing, manufacturing, services, and we've put them together under one leader, and they have exactly one mission in life: to make a successful launch. They have a shared scorecard, Tier 4 on a page, and we have weekly reviews with our CEO. I've been with that business a long time, and I have to tell you, I have never seen the speed and intensity before on a launch like we have on this one. But it's not enough just that the core team and me and a few others are totally dedicated to Tier 4, which is why we've started a little campaign. We wear these green wristbands, and they say simply, "Tier 4 proud." We want everyone in our business totally rallied around our mission about the great launch of the Tier 4. At the same time, we continue to invest, this time in manufacturing. We're investing in Fort Worth, which is a best-in-class facility for producing the locomotives, in Erie and in Grove City, where we do both new and reman engines. We're implementing the things Christine talked to you about in the Brilliant Factory. We have sensors right on our machines because we can't afford any downtime in this year of execution. Those sensors and the elements of the Brilliant Factory have already saved us one point of unplanned downtime, additionally helping us to hit our cost targets. We're invested in manufacturing, and we're expecting our return. As you heard Bill say, this launch is different. Instead of going all the way through the design process and then figuring out if we had what we needed, we've iterated. We used the red team, blue team. We've made changes as we've learned. Instead of launching with one supplier for every part, we made sure we had multiple sources in order to get the best competition. Instead of having just one factory or one site, we have multiple factories, many places where we can manage the wage, the productivity, and ensure that we can execute for our customers. We're implementing the Brilliant Factory because that's what we need to accelerate our cost out. That's why it is a great time to be at GE Transportation. Despite the market uncertainties, we kept investing, and thanks to the GE Store, we're ready. Our employees are excited. They're all in, and they're Tier 4 proud. Thank you very much, and I'd like to call up Dan Heinzelman.
Thanks, Tina. Okay, so I think you've heard how our GRC kind of stands at the center and has helped our product line leaders to bring breakthrough products for our customers. You know, really changing economics for our customers, and we're enjoying a lot of success in the marketplace as a result of that. And what I'd like to now talk about for a few minutes is how we're going to make sure that those new products and this success we're seeing in the marketplace is going to be improve our outcomes and our economics for our shareholders as well. With that, I'd like to just say we're going to talk about gross margins and how we are approaching this this challenge and engaging all parts of the business you know, setting up a framework that we can drive down into the various places that are going to contribute to this. You know, so as you know, our margins have been improving largely as a result of this effort we've been on to improve SG&A ratios or drive SG&A out of the businesses or out of the corporate and the businesses. Gross margins at the same time have been going down, all right, and we've been facing a lot of mixed headwind as a result of a number of new products, number one, and some parts of the business growing faster than others. Services has continued to be a very strong component of the company, and I can tell you, working with the services leaders, that we have a wonderful franchise there and a great game plan to keep that very, very strong. The equipment side has been improving as well, however, not as fast. And the equipment side of the business has been growing faster than services. Now, of course, in time, that will feed the services franchise, we like to see that, but what we also want to see is margin growth on the product side as well. So, you know, we built this kind of programmatic approach, and I'll show you in a minute how we've kind of structured this. In my experience, I think one of the key elements of this is getting all pieces of the business aligned and engaged. And, you know, that means product management and engineering, manufacturing, really all pieces of the organization have to play. And all pieces of cost have to be in play. All right, so we have to have a structure that will allow us to get visibility and drive improvement everywhere. So we've set up this kind of an XY system, right? The Y is margin improvement. There are many X's that will affect that Y or drive that that outcome. And then, you know, my role and some of the things Jeff and I are trying to do is make sure that we can, just like on the technology side, we can use the technologies that we've been developing or experiencing in different businesses, we can be sure that we are moving them out into all the corners of the company where they can be impactful and help us along in this mission. So simply put, you know, why is product and services cost? I want to keep this simple. It's material, it's labor, it's overhead, it's cost of quality. There are a few other little X's that we have unique to some of the other businesses, but we've set targets, defined what those are. We've set targets. We've brought new tools to bear in many cases on some of these X's for different parts of the organization, and we've got owners. We've got names that own these targets within each of the businesses, and we've aligned our incentives. You know, our pay is aligned to this outcome and flowed down into deep into the businesses, so there's no, you know, no confusion over what success is, right, for the company and for ourselves personally as well as for our shareholders. So, you know, we've got a pretty good framework set up. We think we've got you know, good tools to bring to bear and a framework to make sure that everyone's involved. So, you know, Jeff and I have kind of taken this on to drive this across the company. You know, we've got a process with each business where we're looking at their structure and their progress against it. You know, we're identifying areas where we can help or we can bring, you know, some of the store, if you will, to help them through some of their individual challenges. And we've got a game plan within each of the functions around what they are doing that will directly impact this this mission. And, you know, many new tools, as I said, that we're bringing into play as well. You know, so just to kind of give you a couple of examples here in supply chain and sourcing, This idea of achieving cost targets is crucial, all right? And those cost targets need to be set in accordance with what our value expectations are and profit expectations are based on the what the market will bear for the price of the products. And we've got a very strong kind of a correlation now between what the product leaders are defining and what the targets we're setting for engineering and manufacturing in, as we bring these products into place. We've kind of built some frameworks around how we can measure every corner of the company on this very simple thing we call operating cost per hour. So we have a framework for looking at engineering as well as manufacturing cost per hour. In this little example here, this is in PowerGen Services, we have a framework of repair shops around the world. We have closed repair shops. We've built new repair shops. The goal is always to be sure that each year our operating cost per hour is coming down. All right, we've got many tools to make that happen. Some of them are associated with labor productivity or labor costs. Some of them are associated with the places we do business. Largely this is a great example, 16% lower cost per hour over 3 years by kind of using this playbook. Engineering is the same way. You know, we look at where we do the engineering work. We're always trying to find a new place that can contribute to the system that may have cost advantages or be specialized. And this is why I think Mark has research centers in many places around the world. Advanced manufacturing. Christine showed you this morning some examples of how we think manufacturing technology is moving forward. And the way I think of this, we've had a long history of working lean manufacturing and variable cost productivity and many of the proven tools, if you will, to work on improvement in manufacturing. And I think this idea that, as you've seen today, big data, the Moore's Law, Metcalfe's Law, the things that are driving improvement or enabling improvement in our products can have the same kind of an impact in our own operations. And we have to be very deliberate about how we think about what those are, how we develop and pilot them, and then how we move them from one part of the company to another as we prove out these concepts. So we've got both the physical world and the digital world at play here as we in the manufacturing arena as we try to drive this change. This oil and gas example is another great one I love because, as you know, many acquisitions, many, many disparate systems, and for us to look across those systems and find opportunities for improvement is kind of hard work, right? There's a lot of manual searching, if you will, and through some of the big data techniques that are possible today, we're learning of as we apply to our installed base, we're starting to look at how they can apply internally, and we found some great examples around how we can very quickly get cost out by looking at the global source structure, sourcing sources around the world, not only for very similar parts, but also for parts that have similar kind of shapes and characteristics that you might otherwise not look for in this little treasure hunt. So some great tools we're bringing to bear here. Engineering, this is about achieving cost targets early, right? You saw the great success we're having in the markets with the products. We have very pointed targets for getting cost out soon so that we can take advantage of this rapid move into the market and build and sustain a lead in the marketplace and deliver the profitability that we expect with the success we're having on these product rollouts. Should cost tools has kind of been a real new opportunity for us. So we're doing a lot better applying the tools available to help engineers understand what something is going to cost based upon the design that they have selected. And the speed of the situation or this these new tools is giving us more opportunity to not only make performance in the product, but to make product cost targets as well. So engineering plays a critical role here. They're very much engaged, and as I said earlier, their targets, their compensation schemes are aligned to the same outcomes that the manufacturing teams are, the product management teams. So, you know, we've got good examples of how this is working, both on the new products as well as the legacy products. 'Cause we're constantly, as you know, through the services franchise, we're constantly introducing new technologies to the installed base. And, you know, that's giving us an opportunity to not only enjoy that installed base, but to bring lower cost solutions into play as well. You know, so we have a framework trying to make sure everyone is engaged across the company, that incentives are aligned, and that we can deliver this margin improvement, this gross margin improvement. And we got a great lineup of products. You saw a few of them here today. And, you know, I would just reiterate one more time how important this research center, all of the research centers are, as the kind of the glue in the center of this, that's helping us to not only break through on products, but break through on manufacturing and bring that process and technology improvement into play on the margin side of what we do. So, you know, with that, what I'd like to do is shift to Q&A, and maybe, Mark, you can come up and
Great.
If we'll entertain some questions. Scott?
Let me just ask everybody to hold the microphone so the phone can hear.
Yeah, sir.
Thanks. Question for you, Mark, and then I actually have a question for Vic. How do you measure productivity? And when you start thinking about 5% of sales being spent in R&D, and sometimes that sounds like an arbitrary number, you know, was it 4.5, 5.5, 5?
Yeah.
You know, but
Yeah.
At some point, it's a pretty big number. So how do you measure productivity?
So the way we think about what we should spend is in light of the markets in which we play. So we play to win in the games that we're in. So you see in aviation, for example, they're redoing their entire product line now. So we're spending heavily to win the marketplace, and we're doing what it takes, and you can see the results showing there. And that's true across every industry we play. At 5% of sales, in the industries that we compete in, this is a very healthy level for us, so we're quite comfortable. It's quite good. And again, we watch the spending as it turns to success in the marketplace, as Dan was showing you. Ultimately, it's got to fall to our bottom line, so it's that flow-through that we watch. So
Yeah.
Good.
Vic, my question for you is that what technology are you getting from Alstom that gets you excited, that helps you make some gains in your product lines?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And if in the catalog, when you look at it, at the very beginning, you'll see for a combined cycle power system, there's many systems in there. There's what we call the topping cycle, which is the gas turbine, the bottoming cycle, heat rejection cycle, electrical conversion cycle. And we've always had a leadership position in the gas piece of that. The remainder of the plant matters from a cost perspective, and from our customer, they don't get revenue till it goes COD. And so to really grow our business and grow margins, becoming a power plant system design company, more so than a gas turbine service company, really is how that integration of those two businesses come together. And on behalf of customers, to drive the cost of electricity of gas combined cycle down, you really need to do the whole thing. You set the odds with the gas turbine, and we believe that's the value creation device. But all the stuff that Alstom does and the scale of that, coming with what GE does, the rotating equipment and then stationary equipment, we think we can move the industry forward and make it more competitive on a cost of electricity perspective.
I'd add on that point, too. I think in the services world, you know, we've got a fantastic track record on the gas turbine side. In many of the situations with our customers, the rest of that equipment in the plant has actually a larger opportunity or limitation than the gas turbine is. So, you know, it can also feed our ability to bring value to customers throughout services.
Yeah, so, you know, breaking up companies has been sort of popular in our sector and has had some level of success. You know, today's presentation seemed, you know, would arguably pretty strongly against that, I suppose. maybe for each of the businesses, we heard some of this, but maybe for each of the businesses, how do you think your competitive advantage would be impacted if you couldn't leverage what's available here and you were a standalone entity?
So you're asking the business guys
yeah.
this question. So I don't know. Vic, let's start with you.
Yeah, I think you know, it's apparent that the connection, and I think it's an advantage for us, the aviation power synergies, especially in the gas space, are clear.
Yeah.
When you look at, you know, what's going on in the power conversion space, you know, our customers go to market selling electrons, and so that's that whole other side of it. So those synergies, I think, are real important. And without those, I think it would be a reset to how you think about it.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think, you know, you saw in our presentation, three of the four technologies that are making our next generation products sing came from other parts of GE and right here. So I think it would be sizable, both on the original equipment performance and as well in terms of what we could do in the aftermarket in terms of capabilities and upgrades.
I'd say for turbo machinery, it's been so powerful that our competitors are trying to follow the same path.
So just a different spin on the same question. I hope you get some sense that this team is plugged in to one another. We all know each other very well. We actually like each other a lot, and that makes the connection very significant for us.
I have a great example of this, right, that I think is kind of shows how things can work together. In the aviation space, right, which I spent many years, and then in power and water and oil and gas, inspection technologies are critical. Absolutely critical to our ability to improve the product, to understand our outcomes in the factories, et cetera. So much so that we bought a business, when I was in aviation, we bought a business from AGFA, and its focus is inspection technologies for the industrial space. And we have delivered enormous value into our service franchises and into our factories by virtue of being able to develop that technology in the industrial space. Now, GRC, working with healthcare, is the fundamental owner of the root of those technologies that we're using in the industrial space. So technologies developed for healthcare on people, we're applying them in the industrial space on our equipment and the services side of our equipment as well, and generating a lot of value. Those connections would not exist at all, you know, without the ability to kind of come here and talk about the challenges that we have in our different industry segments and brainstorm the solutions. And the solutions, these guys will say, oh, we know how to do that. We've done it over in, you know, we can tweak that technology from healthcare and find a way to inspect a 3D printed nozzle that, you know, is not inspectable by current, you know, traditional inspection means. So there are so many examples of how we do this. It's hard to even begin to kind of describe them all. But it starts with this common kind of heritage of pulling technology from this place.
And there's a talent side of this too that's not a trivial thing. People like to come to work with us because we're so expansive and we're so interesting. Those of you who are here physically will get to meet a lot of the people who are actually doing the technical work. I hope you'll find them very engaging and very exciting. We're able to attract talent like this because they see if they can come and work in the breadth of GE. You go to Santa Monica, California, we're in the edge of Silicon Valley, and you say, why are people coming to work at an old-line industrial company like GE? And why don't they go into these cool, sexy startups? And the answer to that is because we actually do stuff that matters. Really matters to people's lives. It actually matters to the way the world functions, and they want to be a part of that. It's a really important thing.
I add one thing for healthcare, because same thing. You know, we couldn't miniaturize stuff coming from the big systems down to pocket-size ultrasound. We couldn't get the same image quality to the same level without GRC. But I think I'll add one more thing, which is really we come here to discuss really tough problems to solve. You get a fresh perspective from a different angle than you typically have in your own business. You tried and tried and tried, and you get a different one. And that's really a huge asset to this one. And I think it's very hard to find alternatives to that.
Try another question? Anywhere back here. Sorry. Go ahead.
Thanks. Maybe a question for Dan. You had the slide on attacking gross margins, and you had sort of 3 points under that. I'm just trying to understand how different is that versus prior kind of GE practices, you know, the extent to which those 3 points on incentive comp and so on are new, if so, when those came in. Then secondly, just for Bill, maybe talk a little bit about how quickly you think the LEAP engine should get to kind of a mature cost stage, in light of kind of what we heard today, and if you compare it with the GEnx or the GP7200 or other kind of legacy engines.
Sure. So, focus on gross margins. I mean, we certainly have seen the significant results from our focus on SG&A. When I came into this role, coming out of the oil and gas job, Jeff asked me to kind of zero in on this space and to think about programmatically how we could align our attack on this across the company. More similar to the attack on SG&A. You know, the tools are not all brand new. What I would say is the alignment of the structure down through each business to guarantee that we got line of sight to all the costs, the ownership alignment to the metrics or to the incentives and the way that we're paid, that's all new. That all changed in this last year. So we got a good framework. We've got a good line of sight to how everyone can play, how everyone's work contributes to this, good targets. Then this, you know, this kind of ability to learn fast and spread the learnings across the company, I think is. This is something actually, I mean, I worked in the services domain for many, many, many years, and, you know, we've done a really good job with that, moving learning from one part of the company to another through this service council. Jeff said, "Why don't we do the same thing in manufacturing?" And we set that up, and we've got, you know, very enthused manufacturing leaders in all parts of the company now that have carved out these areas that we think we can learn faster together and improve faster together.
Just on the LEAP mature cost dialogue,
oh, sorry.
You know, we're going to get to the mature cost on LEAP much faster for two fundamental reasons. The focus on cost that I talked about, plus fundamentally the volume, the speed with which we start to process that volume does help us. So we probably get to the 250th cost probably 50% faster, fundamentally because of the volume aspect of it. And I think there's an argument to be made that GNX had a bit of a slow start associated with getting to mature cost. But we've reduced the cost of the GNX by almost 50% in the last 3 or 4 years. We'll hit the mature cost in 2016 on GNX, and we're pleased with how it's performing.
Could you kind of frame for us, first of all, thank you very much for buying Morris, because you took me out of the wilderness of 15 years of having nobody care about additive manufacturing. Can you talk a little bit about the metrics that you'll use to assess the spread of additive manufacturing across your facilities? And maybe you could start by describing this new facility that you created to kind of be a center of excellence for it.
Yeah.
But how will you know in 2 years or 3 years if this was a good approach, what the metrics are?
Well, I, you know, first of all, I'd say we've learned a lot from Morris, right, from them coming into the family and some of the early examples of success we've seen in aviation. And I wouldn't say the traditional metrics around cost are going to be front and center. I would describe it more around this idea that we are changing our design execution, you know, opening up the design space that can bring value into the components of the products, cost competitively when you look at the trade-offs between cost and value, you know, created in the end machine, in the end performance. So in aviation, for instance, we have really very good ways to trade off weight versus cost versus product performance. And this additive is very similar to that. You know, some of our early examples, you know, the fuel nozzle reducing, 30 parts to one part, is got some cost advantages, but it really is a performance changer in the way that the part functions in the machine. Now, that example kind of opened up some other parts of the company to start thinking that way. And I believe, to just kind of bring the Pittsburgh facility we're starting up, I believe that we are trying to set up an environment where we can, number one, provide the equipment and a space where more people can learn and we can learn faster together. Number two, where engineers can be kind of exposed to this idea that they have to really step out of their historical biases around how we design and produce things to think about, the way that designs can be changed radically to bring performance. And this center that we're creating in Pittsburgh is going to be, a place where we can learn faster by virtue of being together, where we can develop materials, because materials is a critical piece of this, as you know. We'll have equipment for them to do some of their prototyping. I think this is not for production, by the way. This is going to be for, let's say, that early product development. When we get into production, we create a factory and we scale up. So I think additive is kind of at its infancy in terms of the way it's going to bring value to our products. It's also in its infancy in the way that the process is being developed, for true production kind of hardware. And, we're trying to set up an environment where we can just move this much quicker throughout the company.
So I just want to build on this just a little bit and probably move to a different subject, but just that you know what Morris is, maybe everybody else does not. So the way we got to Morris is Christine's group was developing additive manufacturing technologies here at the Research Center. We do things that are high-end materials, metals, and ceramics. Many other folks do plastic kind of materials. We're interested in the high-end stuff. We have an excellent capability, which those of you who are here will visit today. You'll get to see what we're doing. We have a lot of capability, but not capacity. We bought Morris, which is a 3D printing company. We view them as best in class to give us a lot of capacity to really energize our go-forward process. The aviation guys have them filled up already. That's why Dan's spilling out to another facility. But we're driving this across the company fast. The power and water guys have bought tools to enable their engineers to play with it. If you go to Industrial Solutions in Plainville, they're reinventing their whole circuit breaker line. They're using it to do very fast prototyping. It's all about speed to market, so this thing is really taking hold. So let's go over here for questions. Nick.
Thank you. I had a question for Dan. Back on the gross margins, you mentioned that the mix was a headwind in the last few years, and you've got a nice improvement here anticipated for this year. And I was curious how much of that you thought was the incentives really taking hold versus the change in the mix, particularly as, you begin to lift and accelerate the growth on the data analytics, which is a pretty rich part of the service mix.
Right. So they all play, obviously, right? I think, mix is going to be less of a headwind this year going forward, and part of the reason is because we're improving our margins on the some of the lower margin products. That helps. The services product mix also helps. So you could kind of spend a lot of time boiling it down to the exact 3 decimal point contributions, but I believe that we will see less mix headwind as the margins improve on some of our lower margin products that we're targeting here. And we're not just targeting the low-margin products. We're targeting services and really all parts of the company. And the incentives being aligned is very powerful, right? Because it's, on the mature products, for manufacturing to get cost out, engineering needs to play. Engineering is very focused. There's prime objective, maybe you would say, is new products today. But having their incentives aligned, they are supporting very well, the cost out objectives on the older products as well. So this has eliminated a lot of, let's say, organizational confusion over what people should work on. If what you're working on isn't aligned directly to one of those X's, you shouldn't be doing it.
When, Dan, do you think gross margins would be at a new record for you?
A new record?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm, you know, my goal is to, or my objective is to kind of keep it improving. And, you know, the marketplace is going to have something to say as well, right? We have to keep competing as we try to grow the franchise and be successful with the products. I know if we can drive cost out, we will have a better hand to play. You know, we can deliver better margins, and we can also play aggressively in the marketplace to grow share and volume and the rest. So it's all good, right? As we work on these gross margins, it is going to drive good outcomes all over the business, including for shareholders. And I don't know when we'll hit a record, and I can't answer that.
Do you think that your contribution to improving GE's operating margin will basically begin to accelerate, since a lot of that heavy lifting has been carried by simplification and taking out kind of structural and, you know, overhead costs?
Yeah, I think that this programmatic approach that I'm describing it as is going to be faster in its uptake because of the success that we've had programmatically taking on SG&A. And so, in other words, we've all learned how to behave better in pursuit of that bigger goal. And I think as we set this gross margins attack up, everyone's playing.
Question in the back of the room.
Thank you, and thanks to everybody for great information. So I think we took some takeaways. Obviously, you guys make and sell a lot of great high-value stuff. And you have a lot of really smart people that work well together. And you guys are some of the best in the world at measuring things. And to the question earlier about breaking up parts of the company, how do you think about, the quantifying the synergies between all these various groups? I mean, I look at the ultrasound presentation, which is just amazing. I've seen the baby's face. It was awesome. But how do you really think about that internally? And Dan, maybe specifically for you, When you're really looking at these businesses, how do you quantify that? Any color you could give would be great.
Well, I mean, obviously the numbers, right, are the business metrics. You know, how much are we growing? How profitably are we growing? What's our share? You know, those are all ways to kind of gauge the success of the company by external metrics or met benchmarks. Internally, I think the synergies that we bring to bear, it's really kind of hard to quantify them specifically, but I do know that the LEAP engine would not be as successful a launch without the contributions of some of the technologies that are in there. Same for the H machine. You know, every part of the company has benefited from getting access to things that they would not, that they maybe couldn't have done on their own or wouldn't have done on their own. So I don't, personally, I kind of look at the overall product success, you know, the uptake and the share and the, you know, is it delivering the kind of value for customers and shareholders? That's, in my view, the right way to look at it.
This may not be the answer you're looking for, but it is how I look at it, okay? I ask myself, with all the work that we do, do we have the best aviation business in the world? Yes. Do we have the best locomotive business in the world? Yes. Do we have the best heavy-duty gas turbine business in the world? Yes. Best wind business? Yes. Yes, 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 yes. And then as we look at buying businesses, and the oil and gas space is a pretty good example of this, time will tell if we're right or not, but the theory is that we can buy businesses that may not be best in class. We can bring them into the GE store, and we can make them best in class. I believe we will. We'll see. Okay. John. Microphone over here.
Hey, Mark. Are you measuring and scoring cross-discipline R&D? And if so, it almost sounds like it's already there, but I'm just curious. And if so, sort of what more is there to do, or how do you drive that?
So maybe not a satisfying answer for us. So we don't score it, but we actually put a lot of pressure on the various segments. So Vic and Phil are quite comparable. So where I sit, and Dan sits in the same kind of purview, we can look at what they're doing over here and see if they're doing it over there. And we give encouragement in a very strong way if we see that they need to do something different. And Vic has been a tremendous leader. You may see the difference in our gas turbine business since he's been there. He's doing a lot of great stuff. So part of my role, part of Dan's role, is to make sure we're putting pressure across. So we don't, I don't have a scoring system for that, but we watch very carefully what's going on. And part of my job is to put pressure where it needs to be put.
Are there regularly scheduled, for instance, meeting collaborations between
Yes.
If there are?
So,
I would assume there would be, right?
Yes. So I'm glad, a couple of things that I'd really like you guys to know. So the business teams come here regularly, very regularly, have very intensive meetings. Bill's nodding his head. Bill comes with David Joyce here probably four times a year. It's not just the technical guys. It's the business guys like Bill. It's Colleen Athens, the manufacturing team. They all come together, and we think about what's going on for their future. So we have those kinds of things. John Flannery will be in this room with the healthcare guys tomorrow talking about a couple of their segments. And on it goes. So we do that. And then there's a set of things we call synergy teams. Michael Eitelcheck, if you haven't met Michael, you should. He's probably the broadest and deepest technologist in the company. He runs a series of what we call synergy teams that are very active teams that actually pool funding to do basic things that work to the advantage of all the businesses. There's one in repair technologies, one in combustion, there's one in engineering tools, and on, a set of those things. Really significantly funded activities. The business people get together, and they work on what's important to them, and they share the stuff very, very regularly in a very intense way.
And then where is GE at with respect to the penetration of the Brilliant Factory? Because in theory, right, there's going to be a cost of implementation, but there's
Yeah.
going to be an associated benefit. So it's almost trying to draw a line into the future.
Yeah.
If we were fully 400 factories were Brilliant Factories, what would that actually cost to get there? How long would it take, and what kind of incremental benefit, productivity or margin, or however you want to measure it?
Here's the way that I think about it. Christine and I spent a lot of time on this, but first of all, not every factory is going to be a Brilliant Factory, all right? Because there is an investment and return mentality that has to go into this. There are some factories that are going to be on the leading edge because of the virtue of what they're making, right? And we need, like our CMC factory for aviation, this is going to have to be really, really leading edge in almost every way. But what we're doing as a group, we are starting by defining, let's say, use cases. This is a play right out of the services world, right? We say, what is the problem you're trying to solve, Mr. Customer? What is it that will make your outcome, your business result better? And so we have this conversation with our manufacturing and engineering teams, and we bring the tools to bear. We say, okay, well, we can work on that problem this way. So what we've done is we've kind of lined up a number of pilots that we're working in Grove City and Greenville and Wilmington and many of our factories. And we're kind of working with them to deliver an outcome. So they're number one, what did it cost us to do it? Number two, what was the outcome you were seeking? And what was the result of the work that we're doing? So that when we're done, when we've demonstrated an outcome, we have a way to talk to the other businesses about that opportunity and whether or not it makes sense for them. They could not invest on everything all at once. It would just not make, I mean, first of all, it would be overwhelming, and secondly, it would cost too much. So what we're trying to do is develop these solutions or outcomes, and then having everyone play in the, let's say, the idea that you can make things, you can improve, and then find a way to transition them from one business to another as that opportunity has a cost-benefit payoff.
So what percent?
I'd say we're like, personally, and I'm maybe a little hard grader, but I think we're like probably 5% of what we ultimately could do. what we could do, you know, the future. And it's never, it's not like it's a static finish line either. Because Moore's Law is behind a lot of this, right? As technology enables data to play in a different way, we have to embrace that in terms of how we can make our own operations better. So it's always going to be an opportunity to make things better. And what we have to do is what we're working to do is harness that in our own operations, just like we have been doing for our customers on the services side. Did you want to say something, Christine?
I'd just like to add that I think this concept of the business model we're adopting with this app store, right? Because I think it's very, very important. Brilliant Factory is a mindset that we can say we want to digitize, we want to improve productivity, but to the point, Dan, and to your question, it's not the same everywhere, right? We have different products, different needs. And so by building this toolkit, or apps as I call them, to say, do you need, you know, scheduling help or throughput help or, you know, quality issues on machining, and being able to go into each factory and put the right set of apps together is going to make us right size, it's going to make us faster, and it's going to make us able to invest the right amount in every factory, every business. There's not one blueprint for the Brilliant Factory. Again, it's that mindset, it's that commitment to digitizing and getting better. So as far as we are on the journey, we're building the apps. And as Dan said, we go in, we test the app in one type of factory, and then understand the return on investment, the training that may be needed, and then can spread it quickly.
A factory that would need the least amount of help. I mean, some of our more advanced factories probably need the least amount of help because they're introducing a lot of these concepts right from beginning, right? So the newer factories where we're building something from scratch, we have the ability to kind of build a lot of this in from the start, right? But you go to a Greenville, you know, it's been around for a long time, making critical products for us. We are finding new approaches in that hugely important factory regularly, right, that can bring us forward. And just a simple concept. When we go to customers, we talk about unplanned downtime in services world, right? And they can immediately identify with less downtime and how it will drive revenue for them. And we work on lots of things that can improve that. Well, that same concept works in our own factories. If we have a bottleneck in a factory and we can derive more capacity through that bottleneck by working on unplanned downtime, I have to buy less equipment. I can get more output or throughput. It's sort of like free capacity. It's a pretty simple concept, but the solutions to actually deliver that are not as simple. All right. So, you know, what we got to do is start with what is the problem that we're trying to solve, not trying to push solutions everywhere that don't necessarily have the payback.
We have time for maybe one more question.
One more question.
Two more? Okay.
Thank you. Just want to come back around maybe to a business model question in a different sense. You know, regardless of what your product margins are, right, higher margins would be better, right? So kind of the essence of my question is, you know, is the product improvement push also a little bit of a must-have as opposed to a nice-to-have, you know, as customers are more and more intensely focused on life cycle costs and you're trying to make things last longer, you know, are you perhaps over-earning in service, you know, because of the way the business model worked historically? So is there some fundamental change in the business model itself and what customers are looking for from you? And then that's playing into really this calculus that you're doing on how you solve to an acceptable margin rate for, you know, for yourself and for investors.
Can we try?
You
yeah, okay. I don't see a fundamental shift in anything. We're trying to make winning products with the idea that we'll create competitive advantage and set up an install base that drives service. Nothing fundamental has changed in that model. I would tell you that the whole idea of the industrial internet and the big data ideas we have allows us to expand on that, but it's an additional opportunity. It's not a shifting of margins from one place to another. It's a way for us to create more value for our customer and for our shareholders at the same time. So I'm not sure where you're going, but that's, I don't see a big shift in anything really right now.
That's helpful. I'm just wondering also, just as a matter of point of reference, you know, what percent of your product businesses, you know, are below break even, you know, or are any below break even at this juncture? If the whole fleet is running at 4 or 5%, I would imagine there's a chunk that's actually loses money out the door.
I can't answer what percentage, and I do know that we don't like not making money, okay? So we have a very keen focus on everything that is below expectation, getting it up to where it needs to be. You know, I'd like to kind of build on one maybe element of your prior question. I think what's changed with respect to customers and our products is that the life cycle is a lot more, the way that that product can be a piece of their earning equation is changed, right? And this idea that we make products perform better than the day they shipped is more, we can demonstrate it more, and it's got a lot more popularity with customers, right? So our ability to kind of bring the product side and the services side and now the manufacturing side and manufacturing and engineering side all, you know, into a more of a, through product management, by the way, right, into more of a full strategy for how we can be successful over a long period of time with our products. I think that dialogue has evolved a lot in the company, you know, as we grew our services franchises. You know, one's not successful without the other anymore. And, you know, I'd say we're, customers are at the center of that, right? They're helping us to understand what success looks like. And I think the product guys and the services guys are doing a great job making sure that we're driving our strategies in that direction.
Okay, well, one more question. Wynn?
Yeah, just a question for Tina, actually. As the longest tenured person, potentially, who spoke today, so there's been discussion about this change in the incentive compensation system. As somebody who has possibly seen many incentive compensation systems over the years, how is this being received? How big a deal is it? You know, and really, I mean, clearly you guys were always trying as hard as you could. You know, what actual impact do you think these new metrics are going to have on people who already were, you know, doing a good job?
So thank you for that, and you neglected to add, how could I possibly have that many years service due to but I'll forgive you for that, so that's okay.
As the three-year-old prodigy who
thank
started
you.
Here.
Thank you for that, yes, indeed. You know, strangely enough, we had one compensation program for a very, very long time in the company. We didn't change it frequently, so this is a rather big change for us now. And the impact it's having, we know from working in teams, just like our Tier 4 core team, that the best output comes from a singular purpose, everybody pulling in the same direction. Any kind of sub-optimization of metrics just don't work. And that's what this incentive plan does. Everyone pulls in the same direction. Your success is linked, and I think what you're starting to see, it is having an impact. I don't worry about my metric at the expense of yours. I only worry about the mission being accomplished. So I think it's really having great impact, and it's changing behaviors that just say it doesn't matter if it's right for the supply chain or right for this one or engineering needs to do something else, let's all do it. We have to get it done.
Well, look, thanks to all of you for being with us, those of you who are here physically and those of you who are online. So at this point, we're going to end our broadcast and turn to some activities we have here in Niskayuna. So thank you very much to all on the call.
Great.
Thank you for your participation in today's webcast. This concludes the presentation. You may now disconnect. Good day.